minutes, 90 seconds, and counting.
Say it to me, Santos. It's all to where we go. Say it to me, Santos. shirt.
Okay.
Hi, everybody. We're live. Casey just removed his overshirt. We're ready to go.
Did you hear my question, Casey? Is that a Caseyism, or is that a, you think that's a commonly used phrase?
Dealer's choice? I mean, I don't know.
I've certainly never heard it used before, but that doesn't mean it's not a commonly used phrase.
Yeah, I don't know.
I've seen shirts sold as overshirts, like big, thick flannels and stuff.
Hmm, interesting. I've never seen that. I mean, not that I'm shopping for clothes, I guess, but yeah.
Yeah, although it has quickly morphed into the shirt jacket or shacket category.
No, I don't like that.
I don't love that. I love a portmanteau, but I don't love that at all. All right, Marco, I have a question for you. This is actually, this was posed to me in jest by my friend, our friend, Tyler, who went to Goose with us. And we were talking about Goose because that's a lot of what I do these days with anyone who will listen. And Tyler asked, at what point does Goose replace, or at the very least augment, Phish as the pre-show music for live listeners of the show? And I would like to know the answer, please.
I don't know if it ever will, unless... I thought not. The reason why... One of the reasons I play Phish before on the live stream before the show is that I just have a ton of it. Now, I also have a ton of Goose. So that that is an equal, you know, equal push there. The biggest difference is, over the years, I have occasionally, like, emailed somebody or had a conversation with somebody who's like vaguely involved in the Phish organization here or there, and I've gotten the impression that this kind of stuff they really don't care about. So, like, we're not going to get in trouble playing 7 minutes of a live Phish recording that I bought on our live stream before we go live to a few people. Like, it's not like this. I don't think anybody in the Phish organization would have a problem with that. I don't know the Goose organization. I don't really have an idea yet of whether they would have a problem with us doing that. And it's not worth going through the, like, official channels of, like, music licensing for, because it's like the tracks I'm playing aren't even in those channels. I'm playing, like, purchased live recordings from, like, Live Phish. So, like, there's, like, so it kind of avoids that entire system. Avoids headaches.
That's an astonishingly and frustratingly reasonable answer, to be completely honest. But I appreciate it, nevertheless. That is actually fascinating. So, if you're involved in the Goose organization, then you should let us know.
For lots of reasons. I would love to know people involved in Goose like that, because I have a feeling I'm going to be a fan of this band for a very long time. You know, probably if they stay together for the rest of my life, probably the rest of my life. So I would love to get to know anybody there who might, you know, who might be able to work together in some capacity, or just, you know, hey, I'd love to buy you a coffee if you're ever in New York, like anything like that.
How would you work together with Phish in some capacity? In what capacity would you work with Phish? Please enlighten me about your speculation.
Well, if I ever make my Jams app, so that's the my tentative name for the app that I would make. That is the Jam Band specific music playback app that would have, you know, features in it that. Listening to my live Phish and Goose recordings in just the Apple Music app, it works, but there are, like, organizational and experiential features that I would much rather, I'd much rather it work a little bit differently in some of those areas, or have certain features that Apple will never get around to adding. It would never make sense for them. And if I made an app specifically for listening to these Jam Band recordings, like, I have a few good ideas around how I would do that. But it would never make sense for me, first of all, really, to even make that app. But if I did make that app, it would never make sense for me to try to release it to the public, because the audience would be very, very, very small. And even just, like, just building something that would, you know, how many people have bought, you know, thousands of dollars worth of live recordings off of either, you know, Goose's Bandcamp page or Live Phish? I buy every show for both bands. And they're like $10 to $15 each, and they play, like, you know, 30 shows a year or whatever. So no one else does this as far. Like, you know, the number of people who buy all those tracks is probably very small. And so if I'm going to make an app that requires those tracks to play to be useful, what's that audience size really? Like, And how many people would have so many of those tracks that it would be worth having a special app to help you catalog them and listen to them better or whatever? So ideally,
I take your point, but I think there's more of an audience there than you would expect. And I would also argue that if you did a good music playback app that takes into account, like, this version is good because of this thing, or, you know, so-and-so had a really good run during this
version.
Sorry,
Margo doesn't do apps with user-generated content.
No, I'm even.
That's true.
Fair.
Lots
but
of
I was talking about even my own internal notes. You know,
yeah.
Like, oh, I
yeah,
really
internal,
like this version
because
like
I have a whole system in iTunes/music of like how I rate my Phish concerts and Goose concerts. How I like I have certain playlists that are like my favorite tracks like from each band. I have. You know, I have like a procedure that I go through when I have a new show I haven't heard yet, so I don't get spoiled. Like, it's a whole thing, and I would love to make an app to help with this. But if anyone else would use it besides me, to make that app good, you would need access to the catalog. So really, the only people who can make that app good are either the big music platforms, which won't ever make an app that's good for that because the genre is too small, and also they don't even have access to all the recordings because the bands don't upload them to them. And then, or, you know, the other source of that kind of music would be the bands themselves or a service they use, something like, you know, LiveFish, Nugs.net, or in Goose's case, Bandcamp. So all of those people could make a good app, and LiveFish has an app. It's not good. I've had to use it a couple of times in desperation. I would never in a million years choose to use it if I didn't have to. And so I would love to make an app that would specialize in this, but it would really require the band's cooperation to make it releasable to the public because it would need access to the band's catalog. And however that's monetized, I don't care. But like, so I would have to work with them to really make that the app I'd want it to be.
I don't know. I hear you and I do largely agree with you, but I think there's more of an audience and more ability for you to do this without band buy-in than you would expect. But is that enough to take away from Overcast and ATP and whatever else? Probably.
God, no. I mean,
exactly.
I mean, ultimately, so. Like, if I look at, like, you know, just the dollars and cents, I shouldn't really do anything except Overcast and ATP. Right. These two parts of my work life make the vast majority of the income, and they both, you know, make sizable portions. So it doesn't make sense. Don't worry, I'm not leaving the show. It doesn't make sense for me to ever leave this show or to ever give up Overcast, like, unless some truck of money backs up. But I don't see that happening. So those two are in my life. And so the question is, if I added anything else to my life, like we talked about in a recent member special, like, how would that look? And I don't know. It depends. One of the biggest things is, like, it depends. Like, how much would it need from me? You know, am I doing something that has no server component? That helps. Am I doing something that is, like, building on a part of iOS or whatever platform that changes a lot or that people expect a lot of? Well, that depends on the app. If I know from Overcast, if I'm making an audio playing app, that goes a lot of places. Like that goes all over the system and all over people's lives, and people expect a lot from that. So that is actually a pretty high needs app. So anyway, it'll probably never happen. But if Overcast went away by whatever means that would happen, I have two app ideas I want to work on, and that's one of them. But we'll see if that ever actually happens.
We should. Somebody needs to buy Overcast, so you have the availability to work on this, and you and I can do it together. Because surely that won't strain our friendship whatsoever. You and I working on this, bickering about Dave Matthews and Phish and whatever else.
I think the problem with that setup would be unless we also involved John. We first of all, this show would become quite awkward. But second of all, if it was just me and you and not John, we would never work.
That's true.
Like, we would just like, you know, play around, like, you know, we'd like, oh, check out this clip. Oh my God, did you hear this performance of this?
Yeah.
You know, hey, you want a beer? Yeah. And then, like, we would never get anything done. Like, you and I don't think we are, like, high motivational working people. I think we need external people to, like, be a little bit of a boost. And I think John would be that person. Like, I have occasionally wondered, like, what would it be like for the three of us to make an app together? And I think we see with, like, our CMS, we see how that would be, which is...
Please don't use that as an example of that.
With the CMS, like, you know, I wrote it at first. John took it over and does everything better. Like, just everything. And now I don't even touch it. Earlier in the week, there was a bug that was sending me a couple of crash logs in my email. And I went to Slack to be like, oh, hey, do you want me to fix this? And John's like, I already did. Like, and sure enough, like, he'd already fixed a bug in my framework and already, like, you know, committed, documented everything. Like, so anyway, I do wonder sometimes what that would be like, but I think we already know what that would be like.
Yeah, well, what we need is we need you and me to develop, and John will be our certified Scrum Master.
Definitely not that.
John would fire both of us in a heartbeat.
Indeed.
You're both starting on a pip.
If you're not familiar, performance improvement plan. This is basically mm-hmm. like the first step in firing a person.
This is day one. You just start that way. Keeps you on your toes.
Oh, my word. All right, let's do some follow-up. No, God, I did it. I knew I was
But I didn't
it.
Because it's super yellow and pink, and I remembered it.
John, I'm sorry.
It.
See, I am on a pip now. I am legitimately on a pip now.
But as long as one of us catches it, the system is working.
We as a unit have caught it, and we have achieved our goals. Oh, well, almost. We are about to achieve our goals. John, do you want me to try to save this? Or do you want to save it for me?
I will save it.
Thank you.
This is the time of year. Once a year, I like to give a special thanks to our ATP patrons. Every episode, we give mm-hmm. thanks to our members. Say thanks to our members who support the show directly, yada yada. That's what Marco says in his little end thing. And we do. We love all
directly.
Our members. They make the show possible. We love you. We thank you very much. We thank you every single week. But when do the patrons get thanked? They get thanked once a year, usually in early January. So here we are. What is an ATP patron? ATP patron is someone who's a member who pays for the show to get the member version of the show with the bootleg and the no ads and the member specials. Like, they're your member. But they pay more than the listed price for membership. Why do they do that? Why would you pay more than the thing costs? Well, I have a fact item for that. If you want to learn about ATP patrons, you can go to atp.fm/patron and learn how you can do that. There's a tiny number of people who do this. There's not a lot. Why did we implement this? Because people asked us to, and so we did. We implemented it, and the patrons came, and they pay us more than the listed price for ATP membership because they love the show that much or because they have that much disposable income or both. And so I just want to thank them because we don't have anything else for them. They get a badge on their member page that says patron, right? But other than that, we don't have anything for them. The whole thing is like they're paying extra and they're not getting anything extra. They're giving extra, and they're getting the same thing as all the other members. I wish there was something we could give them. We haven't thought of anything good yet. But what they get for now is once a year, I'd like to thank them. Again, I could read all their names, but that would be a privacy violation. There's not a lot of them, but I just want to say, you're out there. You're an ATP patron. You did that thing where you pay extra money voluntarily. I want to say that we see you. We noticed you. We thank you. Thank you, ATP patrons. If you want to become a patron, even if you're already a member, or if you're not a member, atp.fm/patron will explain how to do it. That's it.
Thanks.
Yep. Thank you so much, patrons. We appreciate you. All right. Some quick follow-up with regard to cutting the cord. As I'm sitting here now, I have not yet recorded, but by the time you hear this, I will have recorded an episode of Downstream with Jason Snell, where we're going to talk about cord cutting and kind of what the state of the world is. And one of the things that we plan on talking about, or that we have talked about, I don't know what is time in this particular segment, but anyway, one of the things that's being talked about is Suppose.tv, which I'd never heard of, but Jason pointed me to it. English, how does it work? And what this lets you do is it lets you pick out, like, oh, I really need HBO, I really need CBS, I really need ABC, I really need Travel Channel. And based on your particular needs, it will suggest what streaming service you should get, like what is cheapest and what is the best fit and so on and so forth. I presume this is just for America. I honestly don't know, but it's worth checking out if you are American and are looking to cut the cord. So I will put a link to me on Downstream in the show notes. It will 404 until the episode is up, and then it will not 404. So check that out if you're interested, and check out Suppose.tv if you're looking to cut the cord. All right. With regard to adding contacts to a list one at a time in iOS, we were lamenting how long that would take. Simon Lungberg writes, the iOS 26 Contacts app does indeed support multi-select using the two-finger swipe gesture. Selecting spread apart items works by doing another two-finger swipe at another place in the list. You can then initiate a drag by holding and dragging on one of the selected items. Tap the back button and drop the contacts in the list of your choosing. Is it intuitive? No. Is it better than painstakingly moving one at a time? Marginally. But does it work? Yes. So Simon was not the only person to write this in. A lot of people wrote in about this, but Simon was the one that best described it. So thank you.
And there was also a second method to do it, which I thought I had saved, but I had not. But suffice it to say that multi-select does work on iOS. It's just not as obvious or as easy, I would say, as physically easy as it is on the Mac. But it's there and it works.
Give me some context on this next piece, John. Did one of us say that the
I did. I kept. Okay. I was complaining about the state of displays, and I kept saying, like, you could do X, or you could get the stupid studio display for $1,200, and I believe I said it twice, so I have been corrected.
All right, so Greg CA writes that the studio display is $1,600, not $1,200. I might have bought one at $1,200. Instead, I converted my 27-inch iMac into a display for less than $300, which I've seen videos about this. In fact, I think Quinn did a video on this, which I'll probably mm-hmm. forget to put in the show notes. But it is very involved, far beyond what I feel comfortable doing. But man, if you want a nice 5K display on the cheap, that's the way to do it.
Yeah, I think I just keep blocking out the studio display at $1,600. I'm like, isn't it $1,200? Then you add like a couple hundred for the adjustable stand? No, it's $1,600, I believe, with the non-adjustable stand, and then you add more. It's ridiculous. I know it's on sale sometimes, so maybe that's why I was confused, but just FYI, $1,600, not $1,200.
Yeah, and we definitely do not have links for the show notes, but for what it's worth, David Schaub in the chat has reminded me that there are a bunch of new monitors that have been announced over the last couple days at CES, and some of them are 5K, some of them are 6K. I have no judgments on these. I barely know what any of them are about, but it is worth looking into, especially once these are actually available for sale. There might be some new 5K or 6K options that might fit your needs.
There are.
All right.
You might hear about them later in this show or on a future show.
All right. Excellent. I love it. With regard to other displays and flickering, or I guess some of the same display and display flickering, Stephen Perelson writes, there have been issues with display support on M-Series Macs since November 2020 with Big Sur. My M1 Mac Mini on a generic Dell monitor would flicker under certain conditions. I eventually found this forum thread, which we'll link in the show notes. In there, I discovered a utility to disable temporal dithering, which solved the issue for me. So, John, what is temporal dithering anyway?
I didn't actually look this up, but I'm assuming it's the display. It's kind of like what plasma displays would do. If you ever see a slow-mo of a plasma TV, it shows a certain set of colored pixels and then shows another set and then another set of colored pixels, and they combine to form the final image. And I'm assuming they're doing that to achieve colors temporally, means within time. You know, like you're showing one thing, then another thing, then another thing, and the combination of them smushed together by your brain makes the final color. And I guess that is maybe the only way they can make certain colors. Yeah.
Did you really not know that? Because you pretty much nailed it. I'm a little annoyed.
I vaguely know what temporal dithering is. That's my attempt at a definition. If I was close, then I got lucky.
This is the reality of being friends with John.
You think
he won't know something, and he frustratingly usually knows it already.
It's about monitor stuff. Like, I do watch a lot of videos about this. But, I mean, it's one of those things. It's like test-taking skills. It's like, well, I know what dithering it is, and I know what the word temporal means. Anyway, go on.
All right, so yes, in short, it's let's put two different colors on the screen and flash them back and forth fast enough that your brain kind of receives the middle of the two colors, just like John said. Anyway, continuing from Steven, in there, I discovered a utility to disable temporal dithering, which solved the issue for me. We'll link it in the show notes. It's called Still Color. Also, Better Display is another one that will turn off GPU dithering. Steven continues, I suspect and hope that this is the same issue causing flickering with Apple Studio displays. I've waited 5 years for this problem to get media attention, and it would be nice if Apple could improve their display support.
I don't know if it is the same problem. I think this might be a separate problem.
I think you're right.
I think there's enough display problems to go around for everybody, but it's good to know that if you have this temporal dithering issue or if you're sensitive to it, there are utilities that you can disable it. I do wonder if disabling it would then like reduce the color accuracy or color gamut of your monitor, but you know, pick your poison.
Yep.
It's only $1,600. What do you expect?
Right. All right. Then many, many people wrote in to tell us that the PlayStation Portal, which is a little handheld screen and controller that you were talking about last episode, can also stream games with a PlayStation Plus premium membership. So jump in when you're ready, John, but my understanding is you were using it strictly to stream games from within the home. The call is coming inside the house, et cetera, but you could stream games from the cloud. Is that what this is about?
I don't have one of these, but I was saying it connects up to your PlayStation that's in the house. And I said, well, you can actually use it without a PlayStation. It will stream from the internet, which in my opinion would be even worse because obviously the latency streaming from a console that's like two rooms over is going to be worse than streaming from a data center many miles from your house.
Sure. So apparently the official ruling on the PlayStation Plus premium membership PlayStation Portal combination for streaming games, 5 megabits per second minimum to establish a session at all, 7 megabits per second minimum to stream at 720, and 13 megabits per second for 1080. Matt Ripito writes, the PlayStation Portal is truly great. John, you need to pick one of these up ASAP. We saw a lot of people echoing that sentiment. Jared Counts writes, I frequently tried to play a PS5 game via the Remote Play app on my iPad with a PS5 controller wired to the iPad, and it works great until it doesn't. I have an old Eero Pro in the living room that the PS5 is wired to and a beacon in our bedroom, and the connection will be good for a while but will randomly degrade. Not great when you're in the middle of a boss battle in a game that has timing-based parrying, Expedition 33, or is purely rhythm-based, like Hi-Fi Rush. Christopher Masto writes, the PlayStation Portal doesn't even have Wi-Fi 6.
Which it's got Wi-Fi 7. We were talking about, would Wi-Fi 7 help the PlayStation Portal? It doesn't even have 6. Mm-hmm.
Blake writes, keep in mind, the Portal requires wired headphones or PlayStation-branded Bluetooth headphones. This makes casual use in bed pretty annoying, and I haven't found a good Bluetooth workaround that doesn't get in the way.
That's good to know, because I would be like, well, of course I can just use AirPods in Bluetooth mm-hmm. mode with them, can't mm-hmm. I? And it seems like, no.
Yeah, sad times. With regard to the AskATP about window minimization in macOS, Chirag Desai writes, I set double tap on the title bar to fill, which maximizes a window the way Marco wants. And there's a knowledge base article that we will link. You go into system settings, desktop and dock, window title bar, double click action, fill. And the description from Apple is expand a window to fill the space between the menu bar and the dock. If the dock is along the side of the screen, the window fills the entire space below the menu bar and to the side of the dock.
Yeah, I'd forgotten. Lots of people wrote in with a double tap shortcut, which I didn't mention because we were talking specifically about the green button. But if I had mentioned, I would have been like, oh, and you can double click the title bar too to do the green button does. But you actually can configure what double tap does to not make it do the same thing as the green button. And one of the options is this fill option, which is what Marco was talking about. Make the window really big, but don't enter macOS's full screen mode where it chops off the title bar and stuff.
And then we have a lot of feedback with regard to Wi-Fi 7. We'll start with Reed, who writes, I've upgraded Ubiquiti APs through the last few revisions. I cannot recommend wasting any effort on Wi-Fi 7 at this point. It's been a rocky road with iPhone and Ubiquiti bugs for at least the first 6 months, and even now I think it's worse than just using Wi-Fi 6. You're forced into WPA 3, which means some devices aren't compatible, and you need to type in your password again on every single device. As a result, I've run a separate SSID for my 7 devices that support Wi-Fi 7. I've occasionally managed to break 1 gigabit per second, but honestly, I typically see around 400 to 600 megabits per second, which is really no better than I saw with my old Enterprise 6 APs anyway. USB Type Steve, great name, writes, I remember trying to switch to WPA 3 back in 2018 or 19 and kicking half my devices off the network as a result. That was the day I learned that very few of Nintendo's devices are WPA 3 compatible. Patch writes, instead of MLO, better speed gains can be had on Wi-Fi 7 by using band steering to push more capable devices to the 6 gigahertz band, and then setting that band as wide as possible for your environment. I currently live in an apartment building where everyone else is using old ISP-provided routers, so I'm the only one in the area currently broadcasting a 6 gigahertz band. That means I can set it super wide. I can almost saturate my internet connection from my iPhone over Wi-Fi.
That's key. Like, I don't think of that because I don't live in an apartment anymore, but I used to. Like, if you're the only tech nerd, like, in your neighborhood, in your block, in your, like, set of apartments, and everyone else has all 2.4 gigahertz, like, ancient crappy Wi-Fi things, and you've got the whole 6 gigahertz band to yourself. And 6 gigahertz is also shorter distance. Someone also wrote in to say it's good because people's stuff is less likely to interfere with each other because 6 gigahertz doesn't go as far and penetrate as far. So you don't have to worry about your neighbor's 6 gigahertz two doors down interfering with yours as much as their 2.4 gigahertz. So, yeah, lots of folks tweaking their bands out there to get better bandwidth.
All right. And then Abraham Vey writes, shakes fist good-naturedly and professional Wi-Fi guy. My response to pretty much everything said on the previous episode of ATP was yes, but also no, but also yes. This includes channel selection, channel size, cell size. And this is the tricky part, admittedly, says Abraham. In that order gets you most of the way there most of the time. So let me repeat that. Channel selection, channel size, and cell size in that order gets you most of the way there most of the time. Wi-Fi is science, not magic, but it's also bad science. And I say this, says Abraham, to every customer. It's funny because it's true. Saul Sutherland writes, I'm a wireless network engineer for my day job, and I have my fingers deep into the WLAN network engineering space. Regarding MLO, there's one great example of how multiple aggregate wireless links can improve the user experience, which exists with Eero's TrueMesh implementation. In John's case, where he has Tri-Radio Eero Pro 6 nodes, 2.4, low 5, and high 5 gigahertz, they actually mesh with each other wirelessly on all three bands at the same time. This allows them to simultaneously transmit on more than one radio to another Eero across two frequencies, or transmit and receive across two radios at the same time, even though in Wi-Fi is inherently half duplex. Unfortunately, this implementation sits behind a patent, but I view it as a lucky benefit that exists in the consumer market, not some enterprise gatekept feature. They effectively did MLO before the Wi-Fi Alliance made it a standard, even though it only exists between Eeros on a network.
Speaking of Eeros, I have some exciting news.
Oh, do you?
A friend of the show, Yoni, heard our recent episode and had a bunch of Eero Max 7 stuff that he didn't need, and he asked if I wanted it, and I said, sure. So he sent it along. I don't know if you know what the Eero Max 7 is. We will link it in the show notes. If you've ever seen those statues that are on Easter Island...
That is an annoyingly good analogy. That is very
That's
well
what
done,
these
John.
Things are like in your house, both in terms of their sort of bearing and vibe, and also their size, because this is the biggest wireless access point I have ever owned. It's not even close. Like, it's they're huge.
Is
like,
it taller than the time capsules with the hard drives in them?
It's bigger, like, because it's wider and broader and also taller. It's thinner, I guess, because, like, they're kind of, like, flat curved. They're like these, they're wide Easter Island statue type things, but they're way bigger than you think they are. Like, I mean, you can tell because there's Ethernet jacks in the back. It's a standard Ethernet jack.
Oh,
then
yeah.
Use that, you know, banana for scale, RJ45 for scale. Yes, I know it's not RJ45.
Oh, my God.
So
there's so much nerdery in, like, 3 seconds there.
the old ones I had, the old Eeros were like sort of low slung, and they've been getting bigger over the years, but these are bigger. But anyway, I knew what I was getting. Like but I want to try, because these, as the name implies, Eero Max 7, these support Wi-Fi 7. I think this is like the fourth time I have changed from one set of Eeros to another, and every single time I do it, I am amazed at how well they do it. Like, I used to say that, like, if Apple made Wi-Fi routers in the modern era, they'd be like Eeros. Now I feel like Apple wouldn't do it as well.
You know, it's funny, actually. I was thinking to myself when you said that, oh, they wouldn't make Eeros because Eeros try to upsell you on, oh.
No, well, that's right. exactly my second
revenue.
Thought. Yeah, my second thought was, and if you're about to say, oh, but if Apple did it, they wouldn't have that annoying Eero Plus upsell, I think Apple would be more annoying
100%.
Than Eero Plus.
Yeah,
because
it would be
I
in the same screen
Eeros,
of your iPhone.
I have had Eeros during the entire time that Eero Plus has been a thing since, like, Amazon bought them. And it never bothers me. It is never in my face. I never get nagged about it. It doesn't appear in any settings screens. Like, it's in the app. It's there. If I go to a feature that requires Eero Plus, it appears. It's like, do you want to do Wi-Fi spectrum analysis? Oh, that requires Eero Plus. But, like, that's me scrolling through a bunch of features and seeing these are the features you could get if you have Plus. They don't throw it at me. They don't email me. It's not an unrelated screens. I never even have to know it exists. They're not crippling their things. Anyway, setting that aside. So I've never signed up for it. So again, you go to the Eero app and you're like, I want to replace device. And it's like, the device you want to replace is your gateway router. If you replace that, everything's going to be offline. Like, it tells you, you know, stuff I already know, but, like, it's so nice that it says, if you do this, here's the deal. And then it says, here's the steps. Do this, do that, unplug the thing, plug in the new thing, blah, blah, blah. Wait for it to, and it just works. And I have tons of settings. I have, like, reserved IP addresses based on MAC addresses. I have filter, like, all that. It's like, it's just completely transparent. Removing my main gateway router for the entire house, aside from everyone being offline for, like, you know, 5 minutes or however long this takes, which, you know, people were home, but they didn't even notice because they were probably on their phones and they just switched to cellular anyway. Totally transparent. And then I replaced a couple other base stations. Then I was like, okay, I realized my mistake that I hadn't done speed tests before I replaced all the routers. So my bad. But I wasn't about to undo everything. And I ended up going around and saying, okay, is this any faster? Well, I did find the setting in the app that said multi-link operation. And their description is multi-link operation connects your wireless devices to multiple Wi-Fi radios simultaneously, providing supported devices faster speeds and lower latencies. Some devices may be incompatible with MLO networks. Doesn't say anything about simultaneous or alternating MLO, but as we know from the past episode, it's only alternating, and even if that, it's questionable. But anyway, when you go to enable it, it says, are you sure you want to enable multi-link operation? Your network will reboot and disconnect for about 2 minutes. WPA3 will be enabled on participating bands. Some devices may not be compatible with MLO networks. And I found this a little scary. Of course, by then I'd read all the mail of people like, oh, I tried MLO, but everything had to be on WPA3 and it didn't work with my Nintendo stuff or whatever. I'm like, well, like, what the hell? I need to try this, right? So I turned it on. I said, yes, continue. the network was down and things rebooted for 2 minutes and it came back up, everything was fine. Like when it says WPA3 will be enabled on participating bands, I don't know what that means, but I can tell you what it doesn't mean is that my Nintendo Switch 2 was knocked off. My Nintendo Switch 2 is still using WPA2 to connect, but it's fine. Like none of my devices got kicked off the network. Everything worked fine. Then I went around the house and did a bunch of speed tests, and I was trying to figure out how I can arrange my set of hardware, because I still have my old Eero stuff and I have the new ones. It's like, well, now I have an excess of devices. Can I add some more, you know, mesh nodes somewhere to help? And in my testing, going around speed testing things on my phone, essentially, which is the most advanced Wi-Fi device I have, is my iPhone 16 Pro in terms of Wi-Fi standards. I guess maybe my M4 iPad Pro, but I was using both of them. I went around the house and trying to see what node are you connected to? Both looking in the Eero app and looking at my thing and, you know, figuring out, okay, well, it's connecting to the hallway one, but it's not choosing not to connect to that one or whatever. Anyway, here's what I ended up with. Not only did I not use any of the hardware that I replaced, like I took out a bunch of hardware and replaced it, I actually subtracted even more hardware by not replacing the mesh node in my bedroom. So now I just have one in the computer room with me here, which is the gateway one, in the basement next to my Synology, which is also wired in. And my theory on the basement one is dead center of the house, but in the basement, and it's wired in. I want that one to project up through the floor to the one that's in my hallway in the center of the house. And that one is not wired in because there's no Ethernet there. And then that one projects up into the second floor. And what I found is that no place on my second floor where I put another Wi-Fi mesh node helps things at all. All it does is provide interference. Devices refuse to connect to it because the one in the center is so much stronger. So now I just have three Eero Max 7 nodes. I don't want to have one in the bedroom anymore. Signal in every place in the house is stronger. From my bed on my iPad, I get like 460 megabits per second down. Which used to be, that's the bad signal place. Like that's the parts where I had the worst signal previously. And I didn't measure it before, but now it's over 400 gigabits, which is great. From megabits, the room where I'm sitting. Well, sorry, yes, right.
That would be really something.
Very impressive.
From the room where I'm sitting now, the computer room where I can't touch the router, but it's like, you know, 6 feet away from me is the gateway router. I can get 900 up and down. So I am very happy with this new setup. Thank you, Yoni. And I'll let you know if anything bad happens, but I'm just an Eero fanboy. Oh, and by the way, I did pay for Eero Plus because I wanted to see the Wi-Fi spectrum analyzer. I'm just going to cancel it after the first month, but it didn't help. All it did was show me it was confirmed to me that I don't want that other mesh node in any of the upstairs bedrooms because all I do is provide interference and no devices ever choose to connect to them because the signal is stronger from the downstairs hallway one.
That's very impressive. That's very cool. I didn't dislike Eero. I felt like I wanted something different, and I personally felt like the Eero Plus stuff was, I wouldn't say it was naggy, but it was gatekeeping some things I wanted to see. I forget what.
There are some features that I can imagine you might want, but I don't want any of the features it's gating, and I just forget that it exists. Like I hadn't looked at it or thought about it until I swapped these Eeros, which is the last time I looked at them was when I swapped in the sixes. So yeah, but there are features behind it, but I don't like. I even turn off features that I get for free. So I don't want anything. Don't do local DNS. Don't try to filter things. I don't want any of that stuff.
For whatever it's worth, I hate Eero Plus for reasons that only apply to me, basically. So I've never had Eeros myself just because they seem optimized for cases where you can't run Ethernet to all the APs, and I've been able to do that, fortunately. So I haven't had that need.
I don't know.
All these Eeros have Ethernet ports. If I could have wired them all in, I would have. Two of my three Eeros are wired into Ethernet.
Right, but I feel like that the main selling point of Eero has usually been like, if you can't run Ethernet to all the APs, they have the fastest backhauls we were just talking about.
That is an advantage. But it depends on which ones you buy because they do sell sets where only one of them, I don't know if only one of them has it. They used to sell sets where only one of them has Ethernet ports, the other ones don't. Maybe they all do now. But yeah, you're right. The mesh network part of it is for like, hey, you live somewhere, you're not going to run Ethernet, you want better Wi-Fi, Eero is a easy solution.
Yeah. The other reason I hate Eero, and in particular Eero Plus, is that I cannot tell you how many problems that causes me for overcast support. Because every so often...
Oh, because of the blocking of things that look like ads, yeah.
Every so often, one of the podcast stats tracking redirect services will be blocked by Eero Plus. And everyone on Eero who has that service, which includes a lot of people who are like not super technical, everyone who has that service will all of a sudden be unable to download like the New York Times podcast, like some really big shows, and it'll just, the downloads will just fail. And if you look at Overcast's one-star reviews, a very common theme, really up to a few months ago, was about download failures. And some of that was my fault, but a huge amount of it were basically people who have either Eero Plus or somebody, they live with a nerd who's running Pi-hole or something, you know, some kind of blocking at the network level, and they're blocking some podcast download service. And it is such a pain in the butt because, of course, like, you know, anything that happens in Overcast, no matter how the UI messages it, like, no matter, and I've tried, like, I built a whole feature to, like, detect whether something's being blocked by DNS and show an alert in the home screen of the app showing, like, hey, I think your network is blocking, you know, Magellan.ai or whatever, you know, and here's what that means, and here's how to maybe go fix it, like, check on these things. Even then, I get emails almost every day saying, like, I didn't block this, what? You know, even though, like, and, you know, you dig in and it turns out, yes, you know, somebody did. Like,
yeah, I have to say, like, I don't make a podcast app. I've gotten these support requests, too, for my apps. And you're like, what? Your net apps don't do anything in network. How could you possibly have this complaint? I'll tell you why. I get complaints. I can't update to the new version of SwitchGlass. I think something is broken. And now, obviously, we all know, well, that's the Mac App Store. That's not you. But users don't know that. They just know that there's a new version of my app, and they can't get it, and they don't understand why. And every single time, it's some kind of ad-blocking thing that is somehow blocking something having to do with the Mac App Store. Like,
oh, it's horrific. Like, it is like, such a pain. Like, it's like back those... in the day, like when I used to work on web apps, and you'd get so many support requests from people who it was breaking for, and you dig in, and the reason why it was breaking is they have some kind of browser extension that's interfering with something going on the page. Like, that was such a common thing in, you know, the two decades and one decade ago. Now, I feel like anything that accesses the network, anything that fetches anything from a remote server or site or anything, we, like, everyone running all the network interference, think VPNs, ad blockers, custom DNS, these are all just making it a minefield of support out there, anybody whose app at all uses the internet. Because so, like, in the same way that, like, you know, you get the email from, like, the Firefox person 15 years ago, and you'd be like, oh, God, what are you running? Like, what? You have no script and all these other things that are blocking my page, and that's why it's broken. But now it's like everyone is running something, and they're getting harder for a lot of people to even know about or find, because it's bundled in as some kind of like, oh, we're it's a safety service on your router that you pay us $6 a month for. Or
it comes from the ISP. Like, ISPs offer these as value adds as well.
Yeah, and cellular ISPs now too. Like, it's such a minefield out there. It's such a pain in the butt for all of us who have to support these things. But that's just part of the landscape, I guess. But, like, yeah, I would never, like, if I, every app I've ever made has dealt with third-party content in some form. I think I have made my last app that deals with third-party content. I'll say that.
My app doesn't deal with third-party content, and I still get the support complaints. Like, you're right. It's just part of the landscape. And to be clear, I'm not actually against these services. I actually think they're good for most people because they exist for a reason. Like, because people do want ad blocking, and the internet is junked up with a bunch of stuff. It's just, it's impossible to be perfect. Like,
yeah, I use ad blockers in my browser, and a lot of stuff breaks, and I have to occasionally go to the other browser to do something.
And like, there is no blocking service that gets it right all the time, and so it essentially requires everyone to eventually become knowledgeable enough to know or remember that thing exists. To your point of like, I'm not blocking anything. It's like they don't realize what they're blocking or whatever. And B, once they do know that it exists, now it's another thing that you have to deal with in your house, right? Another thing that you have to troubleshoot or whatever. But the alternative is often worse. So I'm not against these services, and I don't begrudge people using them, but they do make things harder for everybody. And it's essentially an externality of the, you know, surveillance ad industry that's out there. It's like another bad effect of that we have to deal with so they can make money.
Oh, yeah. And like, you know, with Overcast, it's also especially difficult because there is no such thing as blocking only ads on podcasts and having the rest of the podcast download, because the way they do their ad tracking stuff is they just redirect the download through a bunch of third-party services and stuff. So if one of those domains is blocked, the redirect just doesn't proceed. So the download just fails. Like, there's no... It isn't like on a web page. If you have ad blockers installed, but you load a web page, odds are the rest of the page will load.
Odds are the page will show a thing that says, looks like you're blocking your ads.
Sure. But, like, you know, in the ideal case, like, some of the page can load while you're blocking the JavaScript includes or whatever, but that's not how podcasts work. And as we have all this like network level stuff, that breaks a lot of apps in a lot of weird ways because it isn't a web browser and it doesn't work the same way. Anyway, yeah, I don't begrudge people either for using these things, but if you use one, please know that when your podcast ads start or podcast downloads start failing, and tell everyone else who you live with in your house that if your podcast app starts failing downloads, this is why.
All right, let's talk Thread and Matter. I brought this up, I believe it was the post-show last episode, and I asked, what's the deal with Thread and Matter? And I'm going to try to summarize. A bunch of people wrote in, which is very helpful. I'm going to try to summarize very quickly. Derek Seaman wrote a series of posts about this a year or two ago, which he reached out and pointed me to. And according to him, and I think he's right, almost all of those posts, despite being a couple years old, still are applicable. Derek, from I think his first post, writes, Matter is a software control plane protocol, not a networking protocol for your smart home. It's built on IPv6 and is independent of your underlying network protocols, like Thread or Wi-Fi. Matter devices must support multiple simultaneous controllers. So, for example, Home Assistant and Apple Home can both directly control a Matter device, and the device's state is reflected in real time to both controllers. So that's Matter. Matter is how you control things. Thread is an IPv6-based, low-power, secure, and interoperable radio frequency mesh networking technology specifically designed for communicating with and among devices within a smart home environment. So let me rephrase what Derek wrote. Basically, Thread is how all these devices talk. It's super similar to Zigbee, if that means anything to you. It's okay if it doesn't, but it is IP addressable, which Zigbee is not. Matter is, like I said, how you actually control the devices, and local control is actually a core tenet of Matter, the Home Assistant dweebs, of which I'm one of them, all of them get real antsy and about anything that's like cloud controlled. I actually don't really mind that much, but most Home Assistant people get real grumpy when you have to go to the cloud to control things. They want that local control. It has to have local control. And again, I'm not that way, but one of the nice things about Matter is it has to have local control. And then the other piece is that Thread border routers are things that are a bridge between traditional networks and the Thread network. And for example, I believe HomePods can act as a border router, and I know that Apple TVs can. And speaking of, look who's back again. This is reading again from Derek's series. MDNS Publisher, a Thread border router, uses multicast DNS or MDNS to publish MDNS DNS SD discovery packets on behalf of the Thread nodes so that they can be discovered on adjacent networks. MDNS is back, baby. Who'd have thunk it? We're back and better than ever. I know it never really left, but you know what I'm saying. Then with regard to Home Assistant specifically, Michael writes, to make matters worse, the software Home Assistant uses is the Open Home Foundation Matter server, which is written in Python. But that software has been moved to maintenance mode as they rewrite the entire thing in TypeScript. And that implementation isn't even certified yet. Cool. So that's the summary of Thread versus Matter, which I will probably forget in about an hour. All right, with regard to Apple Fitness Plus, we talked about this off and on over the last year or two. Apple had a newsroom post, which we'll put in the show notes, about this and about Quitter's Day. Reading from Apple's newsroom post, many people give up their New Year's fitness resolutions by the second Friday, in January, also known as Quitter's Day. A new analysis of data over 4 years identified participants with Apple Watch consistently keep up their exercise levels through Quitter's Day and beyond. Notably, many Apple Watch users kept up New Year's resolution exercise levels through Quitter's Day and into the following months. Nearly 80% of those who increased their exercise minutes maintained those increased exercise levels through the second half of January, with 90% of that group also maintaining elevated levels through February and March. So I think that's kind of neat. I mean, granted, this is
fulfilling?
Self-fulfilling, or, you know, they're self-congratulatory. Look at us. If you wear an Apple Watch, magically you'll be good at exercise, which I get that. But, I mean, if the data is to be believed, and I don't think Apple's in the habit of completely skipping over, you know, or fabricating this data, I think that's pretty cool.
Well, and I mean, they probably have cause and effect reversed, obviously. Because, like, the people who are more into fitness are willing to spend lots of money on an Apple Watch. But anyway.
That's true. That is true. But another thing, part of the reason I wanted to call this out is also in the same post, they talk about programs And I'd like to come back to what Apple's announcing, but one of the things that I've noticed as someone who occasionally uses Fitness Plus, and I do really genuinely like it. I think the coaches are generally very good. I think the workouts are fun. They have really great music. The on-screen integration is super great. You can watch your rings close in real time on your TV or on your iPad or whatever the case may be. I really like it. But one of the things that bums me out about Fitness Plus is that I think there's been a couple exceptions here and there, but by and large, all of the workouts are one-offs. You know, here's 30 minutes of strength training. Here's 20 minutes of high-intensity interval training. Here's 10 minutes of yoga, 5 minutes of core, whatever the case may be. And there's no continuity between them. And that's fine, but I have cut my teeth on something that we've talked about many times. It used to be called Beachbody. Now it's Body, B-O-D-I. And there was a whole gross MLM side of it. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the video side of it, which I always thought was very good. And they've actually sunset the MLM stuff in the last like 6 months to a year, which I think is a very good idea. But what makes Body different than Fitness Plus is that almost all of their stuff is a full program. Like, let's do 8 weeks together. You know, you and the coach, you have one workout either, you know, every day or every other day or whatever the case may be. You have 8 weeks together or 6 weeks together, and you're following a program. And this, you know, day one is upper body, day two is lower body, day three is core, day four is, aerobics or whatever the case may be. But it's a continuous, it's a continuity that Fitness Plus has never had. With that in mind, going back to this newsroom post, starting January 5, Apple Fitness Plus introduces 4 brand new workout programs that offer users weekly training plans to help take the guesswork out of how to reach their goals. Those programs include, for users looking to return to working out, the Make Your Fitness Comeback program features 3 popular workout types, strength, HIIT, and yoga. The 4-week plan features 3 workouts per week, one of each type, for just 10 minutes. The Build a Yoga Habit in 4 Weeks program is designed to help users add yoga into their fitness routine. These workouts are designed to increase flexibility, cut down on stress, and build strength and stability. Every week, users will get 2 10-minute flows, one slow and one energetic, that complement their existing workout routines and help build a habit. That is freaking cool, and I think I'll probably try that. And then finally, the back-to-back strength and HIIT program provides 3 20-minute workouts pairing these 2 popular workout types in Fitness Plus, 10 minutes of strength and 10 minutes of HIIT, again, high-intensity interval training, 3 times per week over the course of 3 weeks. The workouts are designed to be done one right after the other with no break in between. The program launches, I think it's just this program that launches January 12 and consists of 3 workouts per week, each focusing on a different body area to learn and practice common strength moves to build confidence and improve users' technique. I haven't tried these yet, but I think this is freaking great. I really genuinely do. And I'm really into the idea of Apple kind of stretching a little bit, you know, and expanding and trying out different things. And I will absolutely try at least one of these. I'll probably start with the yoga habit thing and pair it with my existing body workouts. But I might do the back-to-back strength thing because why not? And generally speaking, after I do like one of these 8-week programs on body, I will typically do like a fitness, a couple of weeks of Fitness Plus as like a palate cleanser. It's the ginger of the sushi meal, if you will. And so that's maybe that's when I'll do the back-to-back strength and HIIT, for example. So if this isn't your cup of tea, that's totally fine. But I wanted to call attention to it because I think it's really, really great. All right, let's do some topics. Let's talk about ASML and TSMC. ASML Holding NV, commonly shortened to ASML, originally standing for Advanced Semiconductor Materials Lithography, is a Dutch multinational corporation and semiconductor company that specializes in the development and manufacturing of photolithography machines, which are used to produce integrated circuits. It is the largest supplier for the semiconductor industry, as well as the most advanced producer of extreme ultraviolet lithography, or EUVL, photolithography machines that are required to manufacture the most advanced chips. This is relevant because the very popular YouTube channel Veritasium just did I think it was roughly an hour long video on the ridiculous engineering of the world's most important machine. I watched it this morning. It is unbelievable. If you like science at all, leaving aside computing, if you like science at all, this is incredible. And within the first like 5 or 10 minutes, the following quote happens, which blew my effing mind. Somebody said, and I think it was one of the employees of ASML, "But as you try to print smaller and smaller features, the gaps in the mask," so the mask is the thing they make in order to, you know, make these chips, "the gaps in the mask start to approach the wavelength of the light that they're using." This is unreal. How are human beings accomplishing this? I don't understand. I do understand because I watched the video, but I don't understand how humans are doing this.
That's why this makes such a great video, because the fact that Casey, who's on a tech podcast, this is all news to him, is like, this is a thing you usually don't have to think about, because, like, I know we talk about chips and stuff, but we're like, oh, how big are they, and what are the performance numbers, and how many transistors, and, you know, how many cores and stuff like that, but we don't talk about the lithography stuff. And we've talked about TSMC a lot, and Intel and their woes, and the problems of having, you know, just TSMC is the only company in the world capable of making the world's best chips, and how that's a problem. And every time we talked about that, I had in the back of my mind, and I should have kept putting in here as maybe an overtime topic, to talk about ASML. Occasionally people would give us feedback about it, and they would say, what about ASML? And I'd be like, yeah, I got to remember to talk about that some future time. And I just never did. So this Veritasium video was a great kick in the pants to me to say, just, it's time to talk about ASML. Here's the deal with ASML. TSMC, you know, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, they make these great chips. To make the chips, they buy machines from ASML, and the ASML machines are the machines that actually do the photolithography, which is like, we design what the layout of the chip is going to be like, and we essentially project it. We take it from this big thing, like, you know, it's, I don't know how big, I think they show the reticles of being like a couple inches bigger or whatever, and we project it down to be very, very tiny. And we expose, you know, silicon photolithography, so on and so forth, which is like, you put a photoresist on certain areas, and you shine light on it, and the part that doesn't have the photoresist gets, like, eaten away, and then you wash it away, and, like, that's how you make these tiny little features. You basically etch them in it the same way you, like, etch something into glass or whatever. They'd etch it into the silicon. And as Casey was just pointing out, okay, well, so you got a mask, you got a thing, you got photoresist, you got light, you shine it, fine. But you want to make things smaller and smaller and smaller. And as you do that, you're like, but now the wavelength of light is too big. It's like, I know how to fix that. I went to school. I learned about RGB and the rainbow and everything. I know that the long wavelengths are red. And as you go shift down the rainbow and you go over to the blue side, the wavelengths get shorter. So instead of using red light, let's use blue light. And it's like, great. Okay, but now we're making it so small that the blue wavelength is too long. Is there anything left of blue? And you're like, I've learned about the electromagnetic spectrum. Can we go like, like even darker blue or whatever? And eventually you get out of the realm of visible light. And they call EUV, what is it called, extreme ultraviolet lithography. It sounds like it's really, really purple. But I forget from the details from the video, but like essentially like you're out of the visible spectrum. Because you're going, you know, you've seen the electromagnetic spectrum with, like, red off to one side, and then, you know, but you get, like, the electromagnetic spectrum is huge. Visible light is a tiny portion of it. We're off the realm of visible light now. And the difficulty, one of the many difficulties of doing this is, how do you produce the light? Like, half of this giant machine, half of this $400 million machine that ASML makes is the light source. Which, you know, when it was just visible light, it was pretty easy to make a light source. Now it's not. It is more difficult. If I'm not going to spoil it, but if you don't already know this, you will not predict how the light is created in the light source for the ASML machine. I don't want to spoil it. The reason I want to talk about it is, and this is a debate in another video we'll link in the show notes from the Great Asianometry channel, which is it's an older one from, like, it's a video from 2021 of, like, who's more important, TSMC or ASML? Because here's the thing. ASML, for reasons that will be explained in the video, is the only company in the world that makes these machines. Like, oh, this is the whole freaking industry. TSMC is the only company in the world that can make the best chips, and they get their machines to do it from the only company in the world that makes them? This doesn't seem like a great idea. And one of the reasons it never came up in all my past discussions, as I said, Taiwan is politically precarious because of its relationship with China. The U.S. is politically precarious because we're dumb. ASML is in the Netherlands, and the EU is significantly less politically precarious than either Taiwan or the United States. I don't think that's arguable at this point. So one of the reasons it doesn't come up is, yes, there's only one company in the world, ASML, that does this, but they're not in peril like Taiwan and America are currently. Not that it's great to have one, but still. And as you watch in the video, you'll see why is only ASML the only company in the world that does this? Part of it is Americans being dumb, because the U.S. started the program to do extreme ultraviolet lithography and then bowed out and said, oh, it seems too horrible, let somebody else do it. And so they did. All right. We put a lot of money into it, and Intel is actually a partial investor in this. And, you know, it's this whole big international entanglement. The bottom line is, one company in the world makes the machines that TSMC needs to make the chips, and only TSMC knows how to use those machines to make them. Like, in the Asianometry video at the end, he gives this analogy of, like, a chef and everything. It's like, yeah, anyone can buy those machines. If you have $400 million, you can buy one. It's about the size of like a small, you know, mobile home. And I forget what the shipping costs are, but if you have to ask, you can't afford it. And I believe it comes in 250 separate packages. Anyway, if you can get one of those and then hire whatever people it needs to run them, still, that's not enough for you to be TSMC, because you don't just say, okay, now we've got the machines, because they will just, they're lithography machines. Now, what are you going to print? And that's all about the, you know, the gate all around transistors and how you're, like, there's lots of, you know, just having a KitchenAid mixer does not make you a Michelin star chef. Let's put it that way. So who's more important, ASML or TSMC? They're both pretty important. But in the end, ASML just has to make the machine and they can sell it to somebody. And as far as they're concerned, they don't care what you do with the machine. Whereas TSMC has to produce the finished product, which is the chips that are all in all our phones and everything like that. So I would say TSMC is more important, but ASML is definitely necessary, because without it, TSMC can't do anything. So this is just a catch-up, essentially, to say, if you kept hearing us talk about this and say, I can't believe they never talked about ASML, now we have. And if you've never heard of them, now you know. There's literally one company in the world, in the Netherlands, that makes the chips that makes the machines that can make the best chips. There are, you know, companies in the world that makes machines that can make not as good chips, because that's easier. But right now, ASML is the only company that does this, and TSMC is the only company that can make the very best chips, with Intel possibly pulling up alongside. Of course, Intel will be using ASML machines as well. And then finally, in the Asianometry channel, there is a TSMC analysis playlist that has a bunch of stuff about TSMC. If you just haven't heard enough about them, lots of these things, like Veritasium does a great job with the channels, like turning everything to kind of like the human story of like, how did this happen? It's not just like these things spring into existence. People have to really believe in something and have to make sacrifices to try to do things that seem impossible. And you get that in the Veritasium video. And same thing with the Asianometry channel, to learn about the history of TSMC and why they are in the position they're in. It is fascinating and inspiring. And even if you just watch the Veritasium video, it is just like mind-boggling to think about, and it really makes you appreciate the all the little chips that are in our computers.
Yeah, I feel like this is very much like the 4-hour Galactic Star Cruiser video, which I just finished watching.
It's not 4 hours long.
No.
What I know, I just thought to scare people away.
Yeah, no, I think it's a little under an hour. But the thing with the 4-hour Galactic Star Cruiser video is that about a year ago when it came out, everyone was like, oh my God, you have to watch this. It's incredible. And I didn't for the longest time because it's 4 hours long. Similar to that video, though, the 4-hour video is incredible, and this 1-hour video is absolutely incredible. And if you have even the vaguest interest in, or most vague interest in science, you will enjoy this video, because basically they had to do like 6 impossible things back to back to back to back in order to make these machines. And eventually, through a lot of hard work and a pile of money, humans figured it out. I wasn't alive during the space race, but it has a similar vibe from the understanding I get of the space race. Like, oh, we're just going to go to the moon and put a human so they can walk on it. Oh, how? And people figured it out. It's just truly incredible. If you have an hour to give, I cannot stress enough, this is a truly worthwhile video. And like John said, it really, really helps you appreciate the absolutely bananas amount of technology that you carry around in your pocket or on your wrist.
I guess the one thing I'm not going to spoil how they do the light source, but the one, this one resonated the most with me, the example that one of the ASML engineers gave to try to explain to you, like, they could just rattle off statistics, but they don't mean anything because you don't think about these numbers often. He gave an analogy that really resonated with me, maybe because of how I think about things, but I'll try to describe it in a way that will hopefully resonate with the audience. So they have mirrors in these things. They spend a lot of time talking about the mirrors. That's not what we're going to talk about. They've got the big mirrors, but they have to aim them really carefully, to say the least. And the way they described how carefully they aim the mirror is like, I give this analogy. Like, if you have like a stick, let's put it this way. Let's say you have a mirror and you attach a stick to the middle of the mirror, so it's poking out of the mirror, right? As you turn the mirror, the end of the stick moves, right? If you make the stick like a foot long and you twist the mirror back and forth, the end of the stick moves a little bit. If you make the stick like 20 feet long, when you twist the mirror, the end of that stick moves a lot, because when you point it to the left and then you point it to the right, the end of the stick that's 20 feet away is sweeping across a huge distance. Like, we all kind of intuitively understand this. Like, you're still twisting the mirror the same amount. You're going, meep, meep, meep. But the longer you make the stick that is sticking out of the mirror, the more the end of that stick moves. Let's say you make the stick a mile long and you twist the mirror. Boy, that stick moves across a huge distance when you twist the mirror the same amount, right? that's just sort of the expansion of like how far does the tip of the stick move based on how far you move the mirror. I hope I'm drawing a word picture here, and you can picture how the longer you make the stick, the farther the tip moves. So here's the analogy they do. We've got the mirror. Pretend there's a stick on it. Pretend the stick touches the moon. Right? And by the way, the moon is much farther away than you think it is. This is a fun science exercise. Go to anybody in your life, give them a sheet of paper, and say, draw the Earth and the moon to scale with their distance to scale, and see what they draw. Nobody will draw it accurately unless they're like a science nerd. The moon's really far away. Okay, that's how long the stick is. It's on the mirror, and the stick is on the moon. All right, how precisely does the ASML lithography machine adjust the angle of its mirrors? It adjusts them enough such that the smallest adjustment it can make, the tip of the stick that's on the moon connected to the mirror that's on Earth, it can move the mirror just enough so that the stick moves from one side of a dime on the moon to the other. A dime on the moon. Because again,
absolutely incredible.
If you like a 20-foot stick and you move that, try to move it with your hands, move the mirror a little bit so that this 20-foot stick only moves across the width of a dime. Try it with a stick that's a mile long. Try it with a stick that's on the moon. That's how precise they control this mirror, such that they can move a stick on the moon. That analogy was just like, that is a way to visualize, I think it was a pico radian or something like that. That is just mind-boggling. It's just like, how could you ever move anything that precisely? That's the analogy they gave. I'm sorry I kind of manged a little bit. They do it in the video as well, but I feel like people will just go past it and like, oh, I guess it's pretty precise. But like the physical manifestation of like the stick coming out of the mirror is just very compelling to me. Yeah, anyway, I still didn't know.
For non-Americans, the diameter of a dime.
It's like a centimeter.
The width of a dime is something like a centimeter. It's according to Wikipedia, the diameter is 17.91 millimeters. So there you go.
I love the metric for all the non-US people.
Well, hey, but no, this is really incredible. I cannot stress enough. You should watch this video. John, you had a very cool topic that you brought to us that Marco and I were supposed to do homework about. And based on the show notes, only I did homework on.
You're the only one who wrote it in there. I think Marco and I was both like to not spoil it.
Yeah, I always keep my own notes for stuff like this.
I know you do.
And so do I. And it's totally a case of move to write it into the document.
Well, because otherwise I don't know where to put it.
He was sniped into
it
because I made little bullet points.
There's nowhere else to write content on a computer.
Yep, no, that's the only spot.
Or in the world.
All right, so John, can you tell us what we're doing here, please?
Yeah, so here we are on the first show of the year. We already thanked our patrons. I like to talk about like what we're looking forward to. What are you most excited about in 2026? Obviously, we're talking mostly about tech things here. So what tech things are you excited about in 2026? And the only ground rules I wanted to put out there is I wanted to say, try to make your things as plausible as possible, which is like, yeah, there's all sorts of fantasies we can come up with, the things we would love to happen or the things we would love to see. But obviously, we don't know what will happen, so I can't say, well, it has to be something that could happen. Like, just try to make them as plausible as possible to constrain us to not be too fantastical. So when we present our list of tech things we are excited about in 2026, you can also make the argument of why you think it is reasonably plausible that this could happen.
All right, who's starting?
I've been doing the order we have. Marco first.
Okay. So what I'm excited about that is reasonably plausible, but not necessarily guaranteed. My own software. I have three areas. This is one. I think it's going to be... I've been working on some stuff for Overcast that I think is pretty cool, and I think I will be able to get it out this year. So I'm looking forward to that.
So we can probably take that item from the show notes and hoist it up. We have an item in the show notes, which is future things Marco does. And it's like, yeah, I don't want to talk about it until I do it. So we're just waiting for him to do it.
Right, exactly. So there's some of that. So I'm pretty excited about some of that stuff. So I'll see how that goes, if I can ever ship it and finish it. Hopefully in the opposite order. All right. So then also, you know, if I ever do make the app I talked about in the member special, probably that would probably happen.
No, not the Jam Music app, Casey. The other
no.
app.
I was so excited.
Marco has a lot of things that he's potentially doing.
Yeah. So we'll see. We'll see if any of them happen. But I think this is a good year for at least one of these things to happen. You know, maybe more. We'll see.
At least one of them, meaning the software advancement you just talked about, or
the new app, you know, or whatever. But we'll see.
But the remarkable. We talked about the remarkable tablet app thing. Like, yeah. That's what you're referring to, right?
Yeah. All right. So then also, I'm also looking forward to, and we'll get to a little bit of this, I think, in overtime. I'm also looking forward to the foldable iPhone. I don't know how that's going to go, but my current take, having both printed out the 3D model of that one mock-up, like I did the 3D printed, you know, size accurate or, you know.
Spoilers for overtime. We will discuss this then.
Yeah. So anyway, so we'll talk about it more in overtime, but I did print myself one of those and I've been kind of noodling with it, just playing with the size. And I think it's really interesting. And it's either going to be some like ridiculous high-end thing that goes nowhere except a few power users, or it's going to be huge, not physically, I mean that too, but or it's going to be a huge transformational thing that's going to become a very big part of the high-end iPhone market for the foreseeable future.
And on that topic, by the way, do you think if you, so let's say you weren't interested in it, let's say you weren't, it wasn't on your things you're looking forward to 2026, do you think that you would actually need to buy one of these to test Overcast, or did you just assume that, like, well, my app is already like adjust to any size, and the size of it doesn't look that far out of bounds, like it's not that, it's not that different from an iPad mini. Like, do you not that would you buy one, because we know you would buy one, but like,
of course,
do you think this is the type of thing that you would have to buy to like just make sure your app works right on it?
I think my app in particular, probably not, but it's so mechanically different. Like, the way you handle it is so different. So I think most people who, like, where, like, your app, like, it, where, like, you care about the design and interaction of your app, probably you'll have to buy it just because it's such a different form factor.
Like, to see how the UI feels. With such
yeah.
A
Even yeah. stuff like just where do you put controls in the interface? Like, how, like, the reachability of things is radically different. The aspect ratio of the front screen, if the rumors are true, is radically different. Like, there's so many things about it. Like, the handling of it is very different. And so I think it's going to be the kind of thing where it's like, you know, if your app, like, if you have an iPhone app and it also runs on the iPad and you never bought an iPad to test it out, like, you could get away with that. It's probably, you can probably make something that's fine, but to really make something that's good, you kind of need an iPad to test that on. But at the same time, like, you know, the world of iOS devices is very big. I don't buy every iPhone. I don't buy every iPad. I used to, like, back a long time ago, I used to have, like, one of every size screen.
That's when there were far fewer devices to buy, too.
Right. There was, like, one to two in each family. Now, there's a million different sizes. Every generation of phone and iPad seems to change the screen size slightly. So there's a bunch of, like, minor variations of screen
sizes. Just to keep devs on their toes so they don't start yeah. making fixed layouts anymore. It's like, oh, we're going to shave off 3 pixels next year.
Right. That's what happens. And so anyway, so I don't buy every one of those. But I think the foldable, if it's real and if it's rumored to be, if the rumors are accurate about, like, the rough screen dimensions and everything, it's so different from the iPhone and the iPad that I think most developers who are responsible for laying out an interface are probably going to want to have one.
I recall you said the same thing about the Apple Watch Ultra, just to give people an idea of, like, oh, but you can just run in the simulator. It's probably the same thing, right? Like, didn't you, like, say that when you did, or maybe it was Underscore, it was one of you two
no,
was talking
me.
About
That's why Apple I have an Ultra, because
Apple Watch Ultra is like, okay, well, yeah, I mean, I have a watch app, and this is a watch, and how different could it be? And I have it running the simulator, and it works fine, and it looks fine, but having it on an actual Apple Watch Ultra still provides insight that not having it would
yeah.
leave you.
And that is the justification I used to buy the Apple Watch Ultra.
I mean, that might have been a flimsy excuse, you tell me, but
well, the reason why I'm glad I did it is because the Apple Watch Ultra, not only at the time it came out, not only was it significantly bigger screen than the series large model was, that's no longer the case, but it was significantly bigger when it came out, but also because it's a totally flat from edge to edge screen on the Ultra. There is no, like, curve around the edges the way it is on the series watches. And that radically changes the interaction and look of elements around the edge of the screen. So when I got it, I was instantly like, oh God, this is very different. So I need to really consider this with my watch app interface. But that was early on in the Overcast rewrite, and I ended up not touching the watch app for like 2 years after that. So my plan was sound. My actions did not back it up. All right, so getting back to what I'm excited about. So I got my software, hopefully, the foldable iPhone, one more and then a subsection. More broadly, the broad part of the section is I want to see Apple's 27 OSs. Now, specifically, this will be the first time we see the liquid glass design get its first, like, big tweaks. Now, I'm not expecting the entire interface to be radically different in 1 year, in part because that's just really aggressive. Apple has done it before, but that is a very aggressive thing to do, and in part because there's still so many bugs from liquid glass and this redesign that I don't think Apple would have the bandwidth to do two sweeping redesigns in a row. But I do think, since we've had that leadership change, there is probably a good chance for some course correction. You know, not major sweeping differences, but tweaks. You know, maybe more. We're going to see a lot more frosting of the glass, I think, in a lot more places. We're going to probably see, like, some of the more ridiculous things, like with the... If I'm honest, I think the worst two things about liquid glass, in my opinion, are blurs that content has to scroll under. So you get blurry content under unreadable text. So, like, the whole, like, blurred bar edges thing. That and the thing where you make up a fake background reflection of the content to slip under bars on sidebars and stuff. Those two are both so comically hostile to so much of user interface design and just honesty that I can see the new leadership maybe having those on their hit list pretty high up on the list. So
on this topic, I was thinking about this same thing when I was filling out the six college Apple report card today. You cited a bunch of reasons why Apple's, obviously, the 27 OSs are not going to be some radical redesign. They just did a redesign. You said they're fixing bugs, and, you know, they don't have the bandwidth to change it all that significantly. The other factor, and why when I talked about the 26 OSs when they first came out, I was just sort of resigned to having to deal with these for the next several years, is essentially just, like, pride in saving face. If there had been, like, massive public outcry to the 26 OSs, then, yeah, maybe Apple could justify, like, we got to do a big hard course correction here. But there hasn't been. I mean, I know people are grumbly about it or whatever, but bottom line is, like, there's no, you know, comedians making jokes about it. It is not terrible in pop culture. Like, they didn't do a bad enough job to justify it. And so Apple, like, even if it's new leadership, they're not going to come out and say, hey, everything we just described, all those tours we had of developer evangelists telling you how to use liquid glass, all those WWDC sessions, all our documentation, forget it all. It was a terrible idea and we're going to fix it. They wouldn't do that for all the reasons you cited, but also because it would reveal a mistake. It's like admitting that you did something terribly wrong. We spent an entire year pretending we didn't do something wrong, and now we're going to say that we did. Even if they don't admit it, which they never would, they would say, we have a new design and we think it's even better. And everyone would be like, didn't you just have a new design? I guess you're admitting that the old design was bad. It's like, no, we just think this one's even, like, they do the typical Apple stuff, but they would never do that. So it's like, you know, again, like, the practical reasons are the real reasons. Like, they just literally can't because they're barely holding on to getting their feet under them with 26 OSs. But also, even if they had a magic wand, from a corporate perspective, especially under current leadership and sort of the Apple IMO for the past several decades, is, you know, if you're going to eventually contradict yourself and correct some mistake, do it far enough in the future to just, like, well, this is just our next revision of the thing anyway. Like, they never fix their problem immediately unless the world is on fire. And the world... is not on fire when it comes to 26 OSs. I think it should be, but it's not because it's too, like, they're not bad enough. They don't do enough things wrong in an egregious enough ways for Apple to correct this. So I totally agree with what you said. Like, we are, if there's something in particular you don't like about iOS 26, if it can't be fixed with, like, a reasonable appearance tweak, you're going to be stuck with it for a long time. And on that front, with the blurs that you were talking about, one of the complaints I've seen from people who, like, are super duper against, like, the 26 OS is they're like, oh, I turned on reduced transparency or whatever. If you turn on anything that essentially disables the blurs, you see just how much space gets wasted. Because when the blurs are there, you can sort of, like, well, where is the top of the scrolling region? But, like, practically speaking, the scrolling region ends once something starts screwing with the content. So when you turn on, like, the reduced transparency or whatever, you're like, holy cow, there's, like, a 1-inch opaque bar at the top of the scrolling region. That's all just wasted space. Like, yeah, before, that 1-inch bar was your gradient fade blur crap thing, and so it made you think your content went all the way up. Practically speaking, as soon as the text goes under the blur area, it makes you feel like your vision is failing you. And so you see just how space inefficient liquid glass is, setting aside the floating bars, which is the other thing I was harping on. And, like, you've made rounded corners, which pushes everything in. You made a floating bar, so now there's margins, and it's just basically there's less room for stuff. And the more you tweak the appearance to get rid of, like, the blurs and the transparency, the more it reveals how space inefficient it is. So I wish them luck in tweaking it, but I really hope they tweak it as hard as they possibly can in 27. But I totally agree. Like, they've got to at least just get the bugs worked out, get everything working, get it functional again. 27 OSs were not on my list, but I see where you're coming from.
Yeah, because I do think, like, there is a lot of low-hanging fruit to tweak these designs into something not only less bad, but actually possibly good. Like, there is, like, not everything about Liquid Glass and these redesigns, not everything about it is bad. Just there's some really egregious stuff about it that I think can be tweaked into something significantly better.
And not all OSs have been equally afflicted.
No, like, I think it's by far the worst on the Mac. The Mac really hurts with Liquid Glass.
And probably the best on tvOS, since it's barely there on tvOS.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, all right. So, finally, kind of under the category of Apple's 27 OSs, but kind of a separate thing. One thing I'm really excited for in 2026, and this is not sarcastic. I'm really excited for it. Apple Intelligence. Because think about it.
It's already here, Mark. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yes. Image generation
got
is here.
Got it on my Mac right now.
Yeah. iOS 27 and, you know, the 27 OSs broadly, this is where we should start seeing the first significant results from all the different restarts and leadership and team changes and the deal with Gemini. So everything we've seen so far from Apple Intelligence has basically been like the version 1 beta that didn't work or never shipped. And they've made a bunch of changes over the last year. That, you know, obviously they replaced the leadership of it. They moved the division around, and they made that deal with Google to have a white label Gemini, allegedly, for some of the back end stuff. So I think these OSs that you know, beta in the summer and ship in the fall this year, are most likely where we're going to start seeing real progress there. Now, I don't necessarily expect the world here. Again, it's only been 1 year since, you know, everything else we've had so far in 26. So, you know, we have to kind of, you know, keep our expectations reasonable for what they can accomplish in 1 year. But this is when we should start seeing actual shifts and changes and results from those fairly large shifts and changes they've made over the last couple of years to try to get this out the door. So I really want to see where this goes. I think it, broadly speaking, 2026 is going to be a really defining year for AI in general in the whole industry, and it can go a lot of different ways. It can be amazing. It could crash hard. We don't really know what's going to happen yet. If AI does crash hard, that has a lot of ramifications for not only the industry but the economy. And so that, like, this could go a very large range of outcomes here. And whatever the rest of the AI world is going to do outside of Apple's OSs, it can go all over the place. I don't even want to speculate because the range of outcomes is so broad. It can be amazing or it can tank the whole economy. And everything in between could happen also. So who knows? But with Apple's platform specifically, I think they will be largely isolated from whatever is going on there in both directions. Like, if the AI world crashes, I don't think Apple's going to be that affected. This is not investment advice. If the AI world does amazingly, I don't think Apple will do amazingly with AI. Like, I think Apple's going to be right in the middle and kind of doing their own thing in their own pond here. But what they are doing is probably going to get noticeably better and we're going to start seeing what Apple actually can do with AI with the right kind of setup. I still don't think they're going to be a leader in AI, possibly forever, but certainly not soon. We're not going to see them competing with OpenAI, Gemini, Claude. Like, we're not going to see them competing with the big models in most of the things that people use those big models for. But we are going to see, like, what's Apple's take on local AI on-device models with some use of servers using Gemini, but, like, you know, mostly on-device still. What does this end up looking like? All the magical fairy tales that they spewed over at WWDC 2 years ago that caused the Something Is Rotten post that Gruber wrote, like, all of that stuff, that's all BS. That never came to pass. It probably never will come to pass. And Apple's probably going to keep trying to memory hold as much as possible because they don't want us talking about it because it's fake and it was always fake. Okay, but this year, we're going to start seeing what can they actually do. So far, they've done very little. But I think, again, this is the year we're going to start seeing the changes they've made start to have shipping results in some form. And it'll probably start small, but it'll be something. And I think that can really be exciting. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it'll just fizzle out and be nothing. Maybe we're going to get another Image Playgrounds are here and we're going to get another nothing year. But I don't think so. I think this is the year where we're going to start seeing Apple ship something good with AI, you know, kind of for the first time.
My turn? Mm-hmm. All right. So I know that in our internal show notes, it says ground rules. Try to make them as plausible as possible. I'm going to start with one that I will concede is not necessarily that plausible, but I really honestly think...
John gets a Mac Pro.
Yeah, right. I really honestly think that there's a chance. So you're saying there's a chance. I think that there's a chance this will happen, and that is that Apple turns the policy corner. And what I mean by that is they start to read the friggin' room and realize...
That's not going to happen.
I know. And realize that it's time to maybe consider that they need to change their approach. Maybe a lot, maybe a little. But I feel like maybe it's time that Apple starts to really change their approach. And actually, I could even broaden this beyond just policy, tech policy, and say maybe they change their approach about other things too. For example, maybe they start rolling out bits and pieces of Apple Intelligence more than two times in the year. And I know they've started doing this, but maybe they like really embrace this. And the kind of unsaid, which now I'll say out loud, corollary to this is, maybe if we get some new faces at the top of the food chain, maybe we'll see a slightly different Apple that maybe will make us a little bit happier, because there's a lot of the current Apple, particularly around policy, that does not make basically anyone but Apple happy. And I'm really, really hopeful. And I really, based on just my thumb in the wind, I really think that there's a prayer, even without a regime change, but especially with a regime change, maybe Apple starts to find a little bit of sanity. I don't know.
I think that's the only reason I'm giving you the pass on this one for the plausibility is because you're tying it to leadership change. Because I think there's no plausibility without a leadership change. That's my opinion. But because there have been rumors that we've discussed in the show about an imminent leadership change, which plausibly could happen within the next year, I think this one clearly is in the as plausible as possible. Though you are kind of like Marco with his Apple Intelligence things. You are being very optimistic.
Yeah, I think too, like, you know, we have, yeah, like the rumors of a leadership change and I think the evidence that, you know, of all the different scheduled retirements.
It's just a question of whether it comes in the calendar year or not.
Yeah. And it's and I think, you know, there's a couple different ways this can go. Like, it is looking apparent that most likely there will be, you know, Tim Cook will most likely become chair of the board. Now, there's a lot of different versions of how that story can go. He could remain CEO for another year or whatever, or you know, a few, whatever he wants to do. But it's what's very clear is that Apple as a company is very patient. Tim Cook as a leader is very patient. And the transition plan, that whatever transition plan they're executing on, they're going to do it at the pace they want to do it. And so I think it is pretty clear that this plan has started moving, but I don't know on what timeline. Like, Tim Cook could still be CEO for another 2 or 3 years if he wants. Like, it could be much faster than we think. He could be out next month, or he could be, you know, still CEO 2 or 3 years from now and just also be chair of the board maybe, or what. Like, there's so many ways this can go. And again, Apple's very slow and very patient, and Tim Cook is very slow and very patient. So I do think this change is pretty clearly happening, but I wouldn't expect anything about it to move quickly.
My second one, which is, I think, moving slightly more realistic, but maybe not, is I wrote it in our internal show notes, AI getting a grip. And what I mean by that is, I think it's clear that AI has promised us the entire world. The universe has been promised to us. And as yet, I would not say it's been delivered. I think that there are times when, you know, LLMs and AI, as it's commonly described, are incredibly impressive, incredibly powerful. I mean, again, I vibe coded most of callsheetapp.com with, I think it was ChatGPT, might have been Claude, I don't remember, probably a combination of both. It can be really incredible, but I don't think it's solved all problems. Certainly the absolute embarrassing disaster, the disgusting things that are happening with Grok right now are inexcusable. And I really hope that we start to get a grip as a society, as a people on AI. And maybe that means the bubble's going to burst. I don't think it's going to go quite that far, but I hope and I think that maybe we'll start to get a grip and maybe we'll start to treat it as being, we'll try to understand and appreciate that there are limits to what AI can bring us and do for us. And that's okay. That's not a bad thing.
Speaking of vibes based, I feel like your first two items are very vibes based. It's yes. Apple turns a policy corner and AI gets a grip. Very vibey.
It is. It is. I started with trying to come up with specific things like I'm excited for such and such or so and so, and you know such and such device or whatever the case may be. And honestly, I'm sure there will be a device I'm excited for. I mean, Marco's example,
something like the Apple's new F1 service or something like that.
Oh, actually, that is a great one. I am really excited.
Look at that.
For that,
helping you
actually.
Out with your list.
Yeah. See, I appreciate it, John. Thanks for the help, Dad. But no, that is true. I very much am looking forward to F1 as covered by Apple, or not covered by, you know, like handled
as
by
paid
Apple.
For by Apple. So you don't have because you already pay for the thing that it's going to
exactly.
come with. So it's saving you money, and potentially they might do new or interesting things.
I'm not so confident they'll do new and interesting things. But it, as we discussed, the way I read the announcements was that at the very worst, they will not take away the new and interesting things that F1 themselves are doing, or at least not for me. So I'm really excited about that. That's a great one. Thank you, John. And then the final one that I had, which is probably a little vibesy for John's taste, is tech experimentation. And the foldable iPhone, I think, fits into this. Yes, there have been foldable phones for a while, but there's never been a foldable iPhone. And I'm excited to see a foldable iPhone. Based on the photos that I've seen, and again, we'll talk about it in overtime, I'm not sure this is something I want, but I'm pretty sure this is something I will get, and at worst, return if I don't like it.
You'll buy it and love it.
I wouldn't have called this. I knew I was just called Marco, my son's name. I knew Marco was going to get one of these. I did not predict that you would expect to go out and buy
one.
Of course. I'm sure you'd be interested
in it.
He's
going to buy
cool.
it, love it, and break it in a week.
I think that is one of two likely options.
Wait. Casey hasn't yet seen the price. And unlike Marco, he could be scared away because the thing is, it's $2,500.
He bought a Vision Pro.
I was about to say.
I know, but that's what I'm saying. He's been burned. He's like, I bought this $3,500 Vision Pro. I'm not buying a $2,500 stupid phone.
No, prices just delay, Casey. They don't prevent him from buying it.
That's true. He gets worn down eventually.
I am so angry at you because that is so accurate.
So what were you saying? Like, so you're looking for it because you think it's cool because you think you would use it? You already said, like, half-jokingly that you think you'd get it and then return it, but, like what's your motivation here?
So all snark and joking aside, my motivation is I think it makes for a better program if all three of us or at least some of us have experience with the device. And so
tech gadget of obligation.
Yeah, no, I really mean it. I mean, and that's why I justified and how I justified the Vision Pro. Now, granted, I wanted a Vision Pro because it's freaking cool. But the way I justified it to myself and to a lesser degree, Aaron, was this is something that I think genuinely improves the content of the show because I can speak.
I need this for my work.
I was going to say intelligently about it, but at least I can speak from experience with it. And yes, I need it for my work. and so anyway, I think I will at the very least buy one and try it. I don't feel like this is a need I have in my life, but every other time Apple has come out with some other thing like the Apple Watch or hell, the iPhone to begin with, I've always started, well, I don't think this is a need I have in my life. And then I've decided, oh my God, I needed this so badly. So I am finally becoming self-aware enough to expect that not only will, as Marco said, I want it, not only will I choke, as Marco said, over the price, but I do consider it, I really truly consider it an obligation for the show to pick one of these up and give it a shot and see what I think. And if I do return it, then, oh, well, at least I've tried it. And I'm excited for that. A lot of this, like, push into the home that everyone keeps saying Apple is doing, but we haven't really seen yet, I'm excited for that. And I feel like just generally, and again, this is, I guess it is kind of vibesy, John, and I'm sorry, but I get this vibe, this feeling that tech is starting to experiment a little bit more. They're either all in on AI, and that's the only thing that matters, or they're doing really loopy stuff. Like, I'm watching The Verge's coverage of CES, and granted, CES is always loopy and weird, but I feel like we're starting to get a little bit of fun back in tech, and maybe I'm just trying desperately to find anything to be happy about right now, but I'm getting the feeling like there's going to be some experimentation this year, and I'm really hopeful and excited about that. So I apologize, John. It is very vibesy. You're right, but it's a bunch of vibes in F1. So how about that?
But I think that's
specifically
reasonable.
Pick that the robot vacuum that climbs stairs.
No. We actually talked about that on Clockwise earlier
today. The pool vacuum that lifts itself out to go into the charging cradle?
No. I mean, I do think that's fun experimentation. I do think that is in the context of tech experimentation, but that's not for me specifically.
The LG robot that folds your laundry?
CES is always like a fever dream of products that never really work or ship. But like,
yep.
But I think you're right. Like, I think you're hitting on something, Casey. Like, there is kind of like this pent-up demand for fun, and I think a lot of experimentation is happening. And a lot of that I think is the phase that we're in with AI, which is like the current next big thing. It's a weird phrase, but it makes sense in my mind. Like,
yeah, no,
you know, tech goes through the next big thing phases. And when you look around like what they've been recently, like, you know, for a while back, it was self-driving. And that was like everyone was freaking out about the possibility of it, and people were using like the early Teslas with autopilot, which is sort of a very limited form of it. But like that, it is happening very, very, very slowly in ways that most people don't have a lot of access to. But it like that was the big thing, and it didn't really result in a lot of like immediate fun or impact to tech products, you know, during the hype cycle. Then after that, we had cryptocurrency, which was not fun at all. For like,
nope.
People made money with it, but it was just kind of like that was one of the biggest moments where like finance bros replaced tech bros, and now there's no more distinction. Now like the nerds are all pushed out of most of tech now, and it's all just run by finance tech bros now. So like that was not really fun either. And then we went from crypto to a brief diversion into the metaverse, which kind of sucked, and I wouldn't describe any part of that as particularly fun either. But then we went to AI, and AI, it is not perfect. It has a lot of challenges. It has a lot of limitations. Again, as I was just saying, like 2026 could be a year where we have a serious correction with AI. But AI is fundamentally opening up new doors and creating new value in tech products that people can actually use and see today, right now. And it's actually affecting our lives right now. Like, I ask ChatGPT questions almost every day about something. It has really, like, replaced a lot of web searching for me, and it has augmented what I'm doing in a lot of different ways. And yeah, it's not perfect. It makes up APIs that don't exist. It makes up facts that don't exist. Like, you know, it's not perfect, but it immediately today has value. And even if it never has any more value than it has today, it still has a lot of value, which is why I think, you know, if there is an AI crash or correction, it's not going to be because AI is a stupid idea like crypto. Like, that's not going to – and remember NFTs? remember when everything was going to move to blockchain? Not the blockchain, mm-hmm. not a blockchain, but blockchain. You know, it's not like that. There's actual value not only being created and not only promised of maybe being created, but that has already been created. We already today have amazing value and uses for the AI that we have already today. And I think if there is some kind of big crash or correction, it's going to be more about like the expectations being even more inflated than it could do, and or all the ridiculous finance tricks that are being played to try to finance this build outs and, you know, all, like, that's going to, who knows how that can blow everything up. But the actual core of the technology is valuable, and it's already here, and we're already using it. And I think that is driving a lot of fun. If we look at it as like the Gartner hype cycle, you know, the famous thing of like, I think 2025 was the peak of inflated expectations in the Gartner hype cycle. I think 2026 will bring on the trial of disillusionment. But I don't think it's going to go that low. I think ultimately, it has those fundamental values established. So whatever the heck happens with like OpenAI's giant build out and them taking all the RAM and whatever, and NVIDIA's valuations and all these big, like, you know, financial and market moving and supply moving things that are happening in that part of that world, regardless of all that, and this is part of why I'm excited about Apple Intelligence, regardless of all that, this industry has created a whole bunch of value already that we're already using to make products today and that we're already using as consumers today. So that is bringing a lot of the fun into this. And, you know, because like what happens is like this is it's opening up new possibilities. It's making things very easy that used to be very hard. It's saving people time, and that changes the viability of certain tasks. So like that's a whole bunch of the good kind of disruption. It isn't just a whole bunch of people, you know, burning GPUs to maybe make some money to buy some heroin. Like it's real value being created here, and people are using it today to improve their lives today already. So I think that's driving a lot of the fun, and I'm pretty. If I go back to the Gartner hype cycle thing, like I think we're going to reach the plateau of productivity very quickly with AI. Like if there is a trap disillusionment, like if we do have like a brief correction or crash, I think it's not going to be that bad. And people who are hoping AI will just go away, I think that's an increasingly kooky position to take. I don't think that's ever going to happen. That's like saying, I wish we could get rid of the internet or cryptography. Or like it's never like that's impossible. It's not going to go away. It's here and it's good. And it's not good at everything, but it's good at a lot. And so we're using it and it's fun. And I think also like what that is doing to the rest of the industry is pushing so hard on hardware, capacity, and energy that we are getting amazing computational power. We are getting amazing computational resources. Now, granted, we can't buy any of them because OpenAI is buying them all. But if there is any kind of correction or you know, whenever things catch up to this demand, we are going to have a huge glut of computing power, of probably energy.
Well, let's hope they build those RAM fabs before the crash.
Yes. But like so like that also is, I think, already contributing to the feeling of fun and promise, but then will contribute even more in the future, you know, once the you know supply and demand kind of balance each other out here, computers are just getting so good and so fast. And they will eventually become so cheap again that's going to help everything we do. Even stuff that doesn't use AI, everything just keeps getting better and faster. So that's also a pretty good reason to be optimistic.
If you watch that ASML video, try not to think too hard about, okay, but what's the next thing after EUV and who's making that and how long is that going to take after you see the timeline of what it took to make EUV here? Things get harder. And as I think we said years and years ago when we first talked about the end of Moore's Law, Moore's Law will end. You can't make things smaller forever. Take a physics class.
All right, John, your turn.
All right, let's see here. My first item, the thing I'm looking forward to in 2026, I hope this is extremely plausible, is the M5 Ultra. Not looking forward to the Mac Pro because I don't think that's plausible.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Right? I'm not looking forward to the M5 Extreme or anything that's like a quad or whatever because that's not going to happen. There's no rumors of that. It's just that's Apple has given up on that. But the M5 Ultra is in fact rumored. We just talked about it in the previous show. It seems eminently plausible. They did make an Ultra of the M1, M2, and M3. They basically said they're not making one for the M4. I would like to see one for the M5. I'd be most excited if it's not two M5 Maxes stuck together. But even if it is two M5 Maxes stuck together, that'd still be a pretty cool chip. I just want to see it. I'm excited for the M5 Ultra. It's been a rough time for me on the M chips. Yeah, they're great and everything, but I'm always looking for the super high-end one, and they just have been dropping the ball on it. Like, they've either just been not making them or making them real late. Setting aside the Mac Pro, just like, it's been harder lately to be a fan of high-end desktop Macs. And it's difficult because everyone else is happy because all the other chips are so amazing. It's like, well, but the high-end desktops, like, no one cares about that. Like, it's all about the laptops. It's all about the phones. And you're right, it is. But, like, here I am. I like high-end desktops. Apple's been dropping the ball. M5 Ultra is rumored. I would love it if they just at least, like, caught up to where they were. This is, like, the bargaining stage that I'm in. Can we just go back to when you did Ultras that had the same number as the non-Ultra chips? That would be great. M5 Ultra, looking forward to it. And if it's not two M5 Max stuff together, I'll be super excited just to see, like, Like, what is their fallback strategy of, like, well, we, you know, their original strategy is we're going to take two maxes and stick them together, and we're going to make this quad thing, and it's going to be amazing. They couldn't do the quad thing. And then the two maxes stuck together, they're like, that actually, that was, like, a money-saving idea, and it kind of makes sense, and it's cool and everything, but it's, like, it does have drawbacks, and it's not as easy as we thought it would be, because, you know, that see how long it took to get the M3 Ultra out the door. And it doesn't give us the clean win that we thought it would in terms of scaling. So maybe we should just make a chip that is bigger than the Max that is its own chip. I would love to see that. I've heard no rumors to that effect. But that is M5 Ultra. In whatever form it takes, that's my number one item I'm looking forward to in 2026. Number two, I'm surprised you two didn't say this. OLED MacBook Pros. I don't even like laptops.
I think it's too soon, honestly.
I think this is the year for the OLED MacBook Pros, isn't it?
I thought we were getting the M5 MacBook Pros like sometime
soon. Yes,
but
also the OLED ones.
No, I think those are M6. I think those are the year after.
Yeah, I know, but I'm saying I think both of those are happening in 2026.
I mean, that like it could be, you know, spring and fall. Like they could
do
that.
Yeah, exactly. Like that was anyway. If I'm wrong about you're right that the M5 ones are not going to be OLED. So like if you're thinking that March is going to come or we're going to have OLED MacBook Pros with M5s, we're not. Okay, that's not the rumor anyway, right? The OLED ones are supposed to come after that, and it is plausible, I think, that those OLED ones could ship within calendar year 2026. If they don't and they end up in spring next year, oh well, then, you know, but I think it's plausible. It's not unrealistic because, you know what? OLED screens do exist. Apple ships them in some of their products. They're really good. You could put them in a MacBook Pro. That's what I'm looking for. Now, the M5 ones will be fine, but I'm, you know, I like, because the OLED M6 ones are going to be, the rumors have it, to be redesigned. I'm looking forward to seeing that, and I'm looking forward to them getting OLEDs because I feel like they deserve it. They're the most popular Mac products. Their current screens are actually really good. Like, it's not like they have terrible screens. They have better screens than any desktop Mac, I'll tell you that. But I am actually looking forward to the OLED ones, if only to see, like, what Apple chooses, because I alluded to in some past episodes, and we'll talk about maybe more CS stuff in the future. The variety of screen technology available, mostly in the TV world, but also in the monitor world, it's really diversifying. Like, it used to just be there's, like, LCD and OLEDs, and then there was, like, two varieties of OLEDs, and then there was a couple of LCDs. Like, there's a million different varieties now. Apple's got a couple different ones, too. Like, their phone ones with the Pentile subpixel sharing thing at, like, 3X, which is totally different from the Tandem OLED that is on the M4 iPad, which is totally different from the mini LED thing that's on the MacBook Pros. And so, like, what are they going to pick for the MacBook Pros? And I'm excited to see, like, a new design for the MacBook Pros. Even though I think the current design is great, and we all love it because it fixed so many mistakes of the past, the new one could make more new mistakes in the future, but it's still exciting. I'm still looking forward to it. I want to see what those are like. If they happen in spring of 2027, oh well, they didn't make my list, but I think it's plausible. And on that front, and speaking of CES, I'm actually looking forward to new OLED gaming monitors. In particular, for my PlayStation 5, I have a 4K 27-inch monitor hooked up to it. And I've been holding off replacing it. It's just like a really old IPS LCD 4K non-HDR 27-inch LCD monitor. And it's fine. I think it's LG. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's old. Like, it's not HDR, and my console is capable of HDR. And it's not OLED, so the black levels are garbage. And, you know, there's no dynamic backlight at all. It's just a constant backlight. And the reason I haven't bought one is I look at them, I'm like, oh, they're either really expensive or they have some compromises or whatever. And this year, like at CES, their various manufacturers are showing 4K 27-inch OLEDs with RGB stripe with no white subpixel, which is like basically everything that I wanted. Like, whether it's QD OLED or not, there's, you know, no white subpixel, a normal subpixel structure, so three vertical stripes, R, G, and B. Not that I'm going to use it as a desktop monitor, but I occasionally do. I'll hook up my laptop to it or whatever, and it's nice to have that, right? If I'm going to spend all this money, I want it to be a plausible monitor. And in particular, I don't want 32-inch 4K. Not because I'm going to use it as a Mac display, because already 4K 27-inch is not the right Retina resolution for a Mac, but it's tolerable. But for gaming, which is what I use it for most of the time, I feel like 32-inch, my wife has a 32-inch 4K-ish monitor in the basement for work. I feel like 32 inches is too big for 4K, even for video games. So I actually prefer, like, space-wise and, like, field-of-view-wise, when I'm, you know, the distance I sit from it when I'm playing with my controller, I want 4K 27-inch OLED, and a whole bunch of those are coming out. I've seen a bunch of them at CES, so I can't wait for my favorite YouTubers to get them into their little hands and test them and tell me which one is the best one, and me figure out which one I can tolerate. I'm not sure I'll buy one this year, because like they can't tolerate the gaming ones, like project light on the ground and do all this stupid crap. I'm not sure I'll buy one, but I've always said by the time I get my PS6, whenever the heck that comes, I will definitely get one, but I'm not opposed to getting one now if I feel like it's finally arrived, the price is right, it's HDR enough, it's OLED enough, I have some faith that it won't, the image retention won't be that bad. It's, you know, it's Pearl Pixel lighting controller bust. It's the only thing I will tolerate. No mini LED, no strobing 1,000 hertz backlights. NVIDIA had some monitor that strobes the backlight to give like an apparent 1,000 hertz or something. It's just, no, they don't want that. Pearl Pixel lighting control, RGB subpixel, no white subpixel. Seems like I might get that this year, so I'm excited for that. And related to that, maybe pressing against my plausibility things, Apple monitors? Eh?
Oh, eh? Amen to that, brother.
Like, there are rumors. There are persistent rumors. Of course, there have been persistent rumors from, like, the day after the studio display was released, where they were like, oh, there's actually a successor coming real soon. No, there wasn't. Absolutely not. But we have model numbers. We know they're out there. They're potentially a successor to the XDR, potentially a successor to the studio. Like, those rumors exist. Those products exist. I think it is plausible that they could come in 2026. And if they don't, it will further cement Apple's terrible drought on monitors. What else is new? But I am actually looking forward to that. Not because I'm like, I'm not going to replace my XDR. I'm fine with it. I'm not going to replace my wife's studio display. It's fine. I'm just excited. I'll just be excited for that turnover to happen. And I also don't think I would buy one as my gaming monitor because it'd be way too expensive or whatever. But I'm excited for Apple to get back on the horse when it comes to monitors. I want them to do it mostly because, like, kind of like the Vision Pro, where it's like they didn't really do any update to it, but I am excited they did something, which shows that, like, it's still a product in their lineup, right? Like, they did put an M5 in it, which is more than they did for the Mac Pro. The more years pass without them touching the monitors, is like, are monitors the new Wi-Fi base stations? Are they just not going to do them anymore? Like, I get the fear. So, Apple monitors, something I'm looking forward to. And my final item is actually one that's already been listed. I described it as LLM-powered Siri, but it's basically Apple Intelligence. I think it's plausible that the stuff that they announced in 2024 and could not do, they make a second or third or fourth or whatever number they are internally, run at this problem. And I agree with Marco, like, leadership changes, the deals they've been making, the technology they've been doing, is absolutely plausible that they could actually release something that makes Siri better. I don't expect the world. I don't want it to be perfect. But like, as you were saying, Marco, like, the whole rest of the industry is doing stuff that makes Siri look even dumber than it already was. Siri was already the laughingstock of the whole industry. And now, like, literally everything that has anything to do with LLM is so much better at Siri in so many ways. Not that they're perfect or whatever, but Siri is just so dumb. It feels like a previous generation technology, because it is a previous generation technology, especially now that I've got, like, the LLM-powered, like, Google Home replacement for Home Assistant thing or whatever. Talking to that thing, it was already way better than talking to Siri. But now it's like, I can just say whatever I want, confident that my intention will get through. Now, will it do exactly what I want or give me the answer I want? No, but at least it will know what I'm talking about. Whereas every time I do anything with Siri, I'm like, it's like playing, you know, a text adventure from the 70s. What syntax do I use? How do I have to phrase this? Recently, I was trying to set up a reminder, and I was very careful not to use, like, the word in or the word year or anything like that, because it was like, I think I was trying to say, remind me to do, like, the six colors year in review 2025 thing.
Oh, forget it.
And I tried to phrase that as carefully as I could, and it still made a year-long event starting at today that was called 2025. It was like, no, Siri, no, you didn't get it. Like, and I'm just, I have so much more confidence in literally anything LLM-powered would understand the event that I was describing and put it in the calendar. So LLM-powered Siri. It won't be the best in the industry, you know, but I just want something better than what we have. And I feel like it is plausible for that to come in 2026. I hope Apple prioritizes the right things. So you're making the jab at, like, image playgrounds or whatever. Like, lots of things.
They are here.
Yeah. Lots of things could ship in 2026 related to LLM stuff, because Apple has been doing a bunch of stuff. But I really hope that someone somewhere recognizes, like, it's all just window dressing, except for the voice assistant, right? That's your big problem. People talk to their phones and their phones, and they talk to, you know, other things, and everything else is making the phone look even dumber. That needs to be the number one priority. Forget everything else. Delay everything else. Delay every other, like, tell me my mom's flight is coming, whatever. Just make Siri better. Oh, my God. So that is on my looking forward to list. And I do think it's plausible. And I just have to think, like, because now they don't have a redesign to talk about in, you know, the 27 OSs. That's got to be the headline feature, right? I don't know how they spin it, but, like, you know, hey, remember when we talked about this in 2024? Well, here it is. I guess. Like, maybe they just pretend it never happened. But, yeah, LLM-powered Siri. And I could have made my list longer, too, because it actually is a bunch of cool stuff that I'm looking forward to. But those are, I guess, my top 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. M5 Ultra, OLED MacBook Pros, OLED gaming monitor, new Apple monitors. I guess the middle three items are display-related and LLM-powered Siri. No TV stuff in there because TV technology is in a weird place, and maybe I'll talk about that in a future show. But for now, you know, this is an off year for TV technology. Just, you know, save your money for next year.
I think we're good.
All right. Is that it? I got to dig out this window. Okay. All right. Thank you to our sponsors this episode, Guru, Factor, and Masterclass. And you can join us. I messed this whole thing up.
You got to thank our members.
I
support the show directly.
I corrected you on the phrasing of that earlier. All right.
Did I get it wrong? What did I say?
Yeah. All right. Thank you to our sponsors this episode. I always say this week. All right, thank you to our sponsors this week, Guru, Factor, and Masterclass. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the many perks of ATP membership is ATP Overtime, our weekly bonus topic. Every episode has usually about 15 or 20 more minutes of a bonus topic at the end for members only. This week, as kind of alluded to earlier, we're going to be talking about the form factor rumors for the 18 Pro and Max, and kind of the headliner is the foldable iPhone and the rumors around that and the 3D printed mockups and everything like that. We're going to talk about that in overtime. You can join us to listen at at.fm/join. Thank you so much, everybody, and we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, so I bought a thing, and it has sent me down the rabbit hole of all rabbit holes, and it is all okay now, but woof, it's been an adventure. This all started when Ubiquiti decided to release something that was laser-aimed, like a EUV machine laser aimed at my face, which was Ubiquiti decided to release a travel router. So I had to have one, and I bought one. Now, let me back up a smidge. What the heck is a travel router? So for the longest time, ever since like a couple of years ago, Quinn had done a different video than the one we talked about earlier, where he talked about, like, I think it was cool, like nerd stuff you could buy, or maybe it was in the context of gifts. I forget exactly what it was about. I'll find a link and put it in the show notes. But one way or another, Quinn had put together a video about how, you know, a bunch of different things that are great for nerds, and one of them was a travel router. And the idea here is, let's say that you and your family are going on vacation, and let's say you arrive at the hotel room. If it's a great hotel room, which this never happens, you'll find an Ethernet port waiting for you, and you just need to bring an Ethernet cable and you can plug in your computer. But that never happens. So instead, what happens is there's Wi-Fi, and there's typically some sort of captive portal that you need to go through and say, yes, I'm, you know, the last name is Liz, I'm in room 123, blah, blah, blah. And if you do that for yourself, for your phone, and then you do that for yourself, for your iPad, then you do it for yourself, for some other device. Then you do the same dance for your partner and their phone or their iPad. Then you do it for your child or children, for their this, their that, their this, their that. And it's just annoying. And so what you can do is you can get these little devices that are colloquially called travel routers. Now, the Mac daddy of travel routers, or in terms of the ones that everyone seems to buy and what Quinn recommended, was one of the many GLINET travel routers. It's not the great name, the greatest name, but these are incredibly great devices. And this is what I have in the tailgate tub to slurp up internet from like a hotspot or my phone, and then distribute it via both Ethernet and Wi-Fi to the devices at the tailgate. I also, you know, that would also do double duty. And when we would go on vacation, I would have that thing, get through the captive portal, and I would have that thing get on the internet. And once that gets on the internet, it's rebroadcast, or not rebroadcasting, it's broadcasting Wi-Fi with the same SSID and password that's at home. So all of our devices, they don't necessarily think they're at home, but they at least connect to the internet with the same SSID and password. This is extremely convenient, just so you don't have to do the same dance with everyone. Now, additionally, if you, say, go to a beach house or something like that, have like more of an Airbnb scenario rather than a hotel, oftentimes you will find like an Eero or some other ISP-issued router there. And oftentimes they will have an available Ethernet port. And if that's the case, you can quickly and easily plug in your router to this Ethernet jack, and then you immediately have Wi-Fi for all of your devices. It's incredible. It's great. I love it. It's a very dorky thing to do, but I freaking love it. Now, these devices are not big by any means, but they're not small. Like, they take up space. I'm trying to think of a good analogy, and I'm really struggling to come up with one. For the three of you that know what this means, they're often about the size of a MixPre 3.2. which is not helpful, and I recognize that, but I don't know. It's probably the same rough volume as a HomePod Mini, although it's rectangular and, you know, in a very different shape and whatnot. So Ubiquiti decides to enter this market and comes out with a travel router. And I took one look at this thing and said, I must have it. Not only is it Ubiquiti, which is my new thing, but it was $80, which is within reason for some of the GL iNet routers, but by and large, I wouldn't say that's impulse money, but because it's, I mean, $80 is not a small amount of money, but that's pretty good. I mean, the family of four, when we go out to eat at a fast casual restaurant, like if we're going to Five Guys, it's $50 freaking dollars. And that's literally poop in like a day.
Yeah,
so,
I'm going to be a contrarian here and say it's 2025. $80 is a small amount of money.
Well, that's true.
For almost anything.
Baby. Inflation, baby. What are we going to do?
Yeah.
So they came out with this travel router. And it is tiny. Think of approximately a regular average size playing card. I know playing cards can be different sizes, but like a canonical average size playing card.
Real time follow up. Thanks, long form in the chat. It's 2026, not 2025.
Oh, yeah. Good point. Good point.
I'm still writing 2025
and all your podcast
jokes. Yep.
Yep. There it is. So imagine like playing cards, you know, ace, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, whatever. It's roughly the size of that and probably like half a deck tall. I know that's very unscientific. I don't have the actual dimensions in front of me. It doesn't freaking matter. It's tiny. And perhaps, Marco, you can make the chapter art a photo of this device because it is so cool looking. And I knew I had to have it. It's so thin that on the one side, it has two USB-C ports. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But on the other side, it has two Ethernet ports, one for a client and one for uplink. It's so small that the top, like, fifth is a door or a joint that you lift up in order to expand the depth of this thing so you can actually plug in an Ethernet jack, an RJ45 or whatever. I know it's not RJ45, but you know what I'm saying. So
it's 3.8 inches by 2.6 inches by a half an inch. So a half an inch is not big enough for an Ethernet port, so you got to have the big mouth.
You got to have the big mouth title. So anyways, and on the front, it has a display. And the display will tell you if it's connected, what it's connected to, how many clients it has, and whether or not it's connected via teleport, which we'll get to in a minute.
Can I just do a brief aside now?
Yes,
please. I don't want to come out against putting tiny screens on every single freaking electronic thing. Like, for this, it might be worth it, but, like, the latest Anker plug thing or whatever has a screen on a million. Every power bank battery thing has a screen. You've got the USB-C cable screen. In some limited circumstances, I understand. I want to see how many watts going through. I want to see the data rate. I want to see whatever. But not everything needs a screen. I know they're inexpensive, but I feel like it's just wasting my battery power for a thing that I'm never going to look at. Again, maybe in travel router it makes sense because you do want to see how it's performing or whatever, but I feel like we've gone too far with the screens. We need to pull back a little bit.
Honestly,
both in car interiors and on electronics.
I'll give you the car interiors, but the other examples you gave, like, so I have a somewhat recent Anker battery bank that has one of those little color OLED screens on it that tells you, like, the wattage in and out. It's really nice, actually. It's very useful to see, like, oh, is that thing charging?
People like them. because they're cute and sometimes useful, but like the smallest little tiny, they're not 5-watt, but you know, like the smallest little pluggy thing with one USB-C port, that does not need a screen.
That's, yeah, I'll give you that.
And their newest one has it. I'm like, yeah, we've gone too far. Yeah. It's too much.
But also, another example you gave on Ubiquiti stuff. Like, so for reasons that I'm not going to have time to get into on this show, I had to set up a new Ubiquiti router at the beach a couple days ago, and it had everything you just said. You said 2 hours ago about your Eero swapping setup. Ubiquiti has all the same joy for me. Like, I had to replace an old Ubiquiti router, and I had a new one on hand, thank goodness. And I just, like, I installed it, and it was like, you want to restore from the backup the old one? Yes. And it just adopted all the equipment. Like, it everything was perfect. And during that time, it had a little tiny, like, you know, 3/4 inch screen on the front of the router that was telling me stuff like, you know, the progress bar to show that it's not dead, it's just booting, and it's, oh, here's the software update, here's a progress bar, like stuff like that. Like, it's just really nice to be able to see, like, what's the state of this thing right now. So honestly, yeah. Disagree on screens being too many places.
I'm just saying they've gone too far. I'm not saying they're useless on everything. Like, there are places, like, I feel like the bigger and more permanent the thing is, the more I can justify a screen. So your Ubiquiti thing, like, that makes sense. But like, the travel router is probably about the limit of things. Like, any power bank that is smaller than this travel router, any power adapter, any cable that, again, special circumstances, if you really want a cable to know how much power is, it's good that they exist. They just shouldn't be on everything. And seeing it put on, like, the smallest, cheapest, lowest power anchor adapter makes me think they're just trying to put them throughout the entire line because they're cheap. That's all I'm saying.
So I ordered this thing immediately. It sold out basically immediately. And I lurk on Reddit, on several different subreddits. And one of the ones I lurk on is the Ubiquiti Reddit. And we're going to come back to that in a minute. But I am super excited to get this. And the Ubiquiti subreddit is losing their minds excited. Everyone is like, oh, I must have this. Because if you look at this, again, you have to be the right kind of nerd, but just look at this thing. It looks so cool. And it's so small, so much smaller than the GL iNet stuff that I already have. And so I get it in, and generally speaking, today, I really, really like this thing. We're actually planning to travel in the next couple of weeks for just a couple of nights, and so I'm planning to bring this with us. We'll probably bring one of the GL iNet ones that I have as a backup, just in case, but I have no expectation that I'll need it. But I really, really like it. It seems to work really, really well. It's not super crazy, ridiculous fast. Like, I connected it at a friend's house to their symmetric gigabit Ethernet or Fios, and it would get via Ethernet like 300 megabits a second down. But the thing is the size of a playing card, for goodness sakes. Like, I'm not trying to download ISOs or, you know, whatever while I'm on vacation. I just want to have something that I can maybe physically plug an Apple TV into and then distribute Wi-Fi to everything else.
Do you think the number of times people have said they've downloaded ISOs is higher than the actual number of times people have downloaded ISOs?
I think maybe just a little. A couple things that confused me or I didn't like at first. The way you interact with this is through the Unify app, which is kind of like equivalent to the Eero app, if you will. And what happens is it pairs, well, not even pairs, I shouldn't say pairs, it just finds the travel router via Bluetooth, which I dig, and it's pretty quick to find it. But then when it brings up a modal to interact with the travel router, and you can set settings and do things like that. But once you dismiss the modal, it is extraordinarily not obvious what you do to get back to that modal. And it turns out that what you have to do is go into the section, I forget the term for it, but where you look at the other networks that you have access to, which for me is
site
only
manager.
My one. Thank you. That's it. Site manager. You go up to the site manager and it appears in there. But what's super trick about this thing, and part of the reason d'etre, or however you pronounce it, that it exists, is that when you set it up.
I'm already hearing about that.
Yeah, I didn't blink an eye because I thought you were right, but here we are.
Turns out it's Trough.
I put a link to the Trough disillusionment in the chat room.
I saw it. It's in the show notes. I saw it. So the way it's supposed to work is when you first connect it, it says, all right, what networks do you have access to? And which one of these networks would you like to basically rebroadcast? So, Marco, if you got one of these, you could choose. Do you want it to rebroadcast the beach network, the Long Island network, or the restaurant network? And mm-hmm. You could do any of the above. And I believe you can swap between them. And once you tell it that, it will slurp up, you know, your Wi-Fi credentials and all you need to do. And then suddenly, now I have my Wi-Fi network on this little tiny device. And that's really, really cool. And it worked pretty well for the most part. The only real complaint I have about it today, although we're going to go through a journey together, so buckle up. The only real complaint I have about it today is that every time I connect it to my phone for tethering purposes, and I believe this is true of my iPad as well, every single time they connect to each other, I get the dialogue on my iPhone, trust this computer, enter your password. Maybe this is a setting that I've flipped that I should unflip. This might be a Casey problem, but I'm pretty sure it's applicable on both the iPad and the phone. And it's very annoying that you have to do this every single freaking time. It doesn't remember that you've blessed this device. I don't know if it's doing some sort of like USB equivalent of like MAC address rotation or something like that. Who knows? But that's annoying. Additionally, I couldn't figure out, like I said, how to get back to the thing after I'd closed that dialogue. But as Marco said, you know, you go to the site manager and that's fine. So this is all well and good, and I got this, and then for the first time, I set up what Ubiquiti calls Teleport. And what Teleport is like a zero-config VPN, and you can use their one of their other apps called Wi-Fi Man. I'm not really sure why that's where they put it, but that's where it is, to use this zero-config VPN to bring your device, your phone or your iPad or what have you, back into your home network. And I believe there's an equivalent for the Mac as well. I've never done it on the Mac. And the idea is that the Ubiquiti travel router has its own teleport. So not only will you be rebroadcasting your own Wi-Fi, but it will actually join your network via VPN, to the point that I actually took a spare Flex Mini or whatever this thing is called, you know, the little baby five-port switches that they have. I had one that I had previously factory reset deliberately. I plugged it in to the Ethernet on the travel router and adopted it through my iPhone cellular connection, which is bananas. So it became a part of my network through my iPhone, through the travel router, which is nuts. Very, very cool stuff. Additionally, if you have a UniFi Protect camera, it will also be able to stream to your DVR, or in my case, a Cloud Gateway Fiber, at home via the travel router if the connection is strong enough, if the internet connection is strong enough. So I could bring a camera with me to vacation and keep an eye on like Penny if we're traveling with her or something like that, which is super freaking cool. Your entire network is where the travel router is. And I think that's extremely cool. So I want to try this out. I've never used Teleport before. So Teleport has a lot of options in the website, on the Ubiquiti like web configurator. I'm going to tell you all the options. Here we go. Is Teleport on or off? There's your options. So I turned Teleport on and I gave that a shot, and I connected to it via either my computer or my iPad. It doesn't really matter. And I think to myself, all right, I'm going to see if I can SSH into my Synology, because that will be a great test to see whether or not I I'm back on my home network. My home network is 192.168.17. whatever. This network, I think by default was .3. whatever. But I want to see if I can reach into my Synology, and it doesn't work. Meanwhile, I'm still cruising, and for the last several days, when I'm waiting for it to arrive while it's shipped, I'm cruising the Ubiquiti subreddit, and everyone's losing their ever-loving frickin' minds for mostly dumb reasons. John, what was the thing on Slashdot where they panned the original iPod?
Less space than a Nomad
less
lame?
Less space than a Nomad. Yeah, there it is. No wireless, less space than a Nomad lame.
Exactly. All I saw was Wi-Fi 5, lame. Again, it's a travel router. I agree. If you wanted this to be your home router, that's wrong on a million levels. But Wi-Fi 5, maybe not great. It's
work great
travel
with a PlayStation
router.
Portal.
Or that's true. Yeah, I mean, it's equivalent to the PlayStation thing.
Yeah, most of these people, like, if you went to their house and you replaced their Wi-Fi 7 gear with Wi-Fi 5 gear, how long would it take them to notice?
Also true. So, yeah. So, yeah, Wi-Fi 5, lame. Teleport doesn't work, lame. Which I think that there's some truth to that, which we'll get to in a second. It leaks DNS, because one of the things that it's supposed to do is if it finds a captive portal, so it can connect to other Wi-Fi, just like my GLINet can. It can connect to like a hotel Wi-Fi. It is supposed to basically push that captive portal to your client device, like your iPhone or your iPad or whatever, have you log in, and then magic happens, and then it will be through that captive portal and get on the internet. And people are saying, well, it's leaking DNS. And, well, of course, it has to use the local DNS to get to the captive portal, right? But then after that, you're not using Teleport's DNS. You're using local DNS. You're leaking DNS. Ah! Everyone's losing their minds because Reddit. But I'm starting to get myself a little spun up about this because everyone's getting real annoyed about how this thing is like shipping with crappy firmware. It doesn't work for beans. It's beta, blah, blah, blah. Everyone's upset. So in summary, I don't know what the hell I was doing and I shouldn't have listened to Reddit. But to get there, I initially tried to set it up and I tried to set up with Teleport and that didn't seem to work at all. It wouldn't connect. I tried factoring resetting a couple times. That didn't seem to work. Then once I got Teleport to seem to work, then the internet wouldn't work when I was connecting to it via the travel router. Now I understand why, but I didn't at the time. I eventually put the DNS on the way I had DNS on the Cloud Gateway Fiber, the router here at the house, was that DHCP clients would be issued the pi-hole address as the DNS. So the Cloud Gateway Fiber has the actual Fios DNS in it, but it's issuing to all the DHCP clients the pi-hole DNS. And that seemed to work just great. But when I did that and when I tried to do that and when I had Teleport on, when I connected to the travel router, it didn't work for beans. The internet wouldn't work. Clearly DNS wasn't working. And so what I did was on the Cloud Gateway Fiber, I stopped having it give the pi-hole as the DNS server to DHCP clients. And then suddenly the internet started working on Teleport. Now this... In the middle of this, everyone is also losing their minds because, to be honest, the software both on the iOS side and on the firmware side was not 100% baked. And so a lot of people noticed that there was a firmware release on New Year's Eve, on John's birthday, but the iOS app at the time was incapable of upgrading the firmware. There was a button to do it, but it didn't work. So then what people realized is if you go to the Ubiquiti apps test flight and then go back like two or three versions, there was briefly a version that would let you set the SSH password for the travel router, and then you could SSH into the travel router and force a firmware upgrade that way, which I did. And that did make things better, but things still weren't right. I am losing my mind. I cannot figure out why it is that I can't get the internet to work right. I can't SSH into my Synology. Why is this not working? What is wrong?
Can I take a guess?
Yes, please.
All right. You said you're using Ubiquiti's Teleport feature to bridge the networks, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Are you cheating? Because he did spoil this already on Mastodon.
No, I'm not. Well, I'm only cheating a little bit because I tried doing exactly this before. Earlier in the last year... there was a point where I was not at the beach. Like I was somewhere on the mainland and something was going on where I wanted to access the beach network. Like I needed to access the mixer. Like there was a DJ and there was something not working right and I wanted to log in and access the digital mixer using their app on my iPad in my house into the restaurant's network. And so it's like, all right, get me on the restaurant network. And I didn't have anything set up except I had access to the Ubiquiti control panel that I had the mm-hmm. site manager. So I was like, okay, well, mm-hmm. I have that. What can I do? And the first thing I thought of, there's this Teleport thing that will bridge the network I'm on, my home network, to the restaurant network. Great. I'll do that. And no matter what I did, I could not get the two networks. Like I could get, if I did like, you know, what is my IP.com or whatever, like I could have my traffic proxied through the restaurant's internet connection, like a VPN, mm-hmm. like a relay. But I was never able to see the restaurant's network's internal devices.
Yep, that's what
and I through a bunch of research and trial and errors, it seems like there is some kind of default behavior, and maybe it's like with subnets or something, or you know, virtual networks or whatever they like. All these like these deeper layers of networking that I usually don't mess with because I'm not good mm-hmm. at them, and you know, like VLANs, like all this stuff. Like there was some kind of isolation that it was that Teleport forced by default, whether it was a subnet or a VLAN or something like that. And I, no matter what I did, I went into like the firewall rules and everything, and mm-hmm. I could not get it to work no matter what. Eventually, I just gave up. But I think I spent like 3 hours trying to get it to work, and I could never get it to work.
So that's exactly where I was, right? Every time I connect via Teleport and I try to ping or SSH into the Synology, it doesn't work. I am asking around on a private Slack that I'm a part of that has a bunch of really smart people on it. I'm asking around everywhere. I hadn't gotten to Mastodon at this point. I'm asking around everywhere, and I cannot figure it out. Eventually, I got so desperate that I started a chat with Ubiquity support and said, please help me. I don't understand. I cannot get to any internal device from this travel router. And actually, at this point, I had come to realize I can't do it from teleport at all, because I had ended up putting the teleport stuff and Wi-Fi man and whatnot on my iPad, which has a cellular connection, and trying that, and that couldn't get to the Synology or any other internal host, right? So I get on Ubiquity support, and I do a chat with them, and they're very kind and very polite and very patient, and I explain what's going on, and the person I was speaking to, I think his name is Peter or something like that, says, well, do you have any switches or wireless access points or anything on the network? I said, yeah. Well, ping one of those, because Ubiquity stuff, all of their actual network devices also pull IP addresses. So I ping, I knew I could ping the Cloud Gateway Fiber, the router, but I couldn't ping anything else as far as I could tell. So I go to ping one of the switches. Works. I go to ping a wireless access point. That works. So suddenly, it's not that I can't get to any of the internal network. It's that I can only get to Ubiquity stuff. And the support person basically said, at this point, was like, well, my job here is done. Get out of here. I mean, it was nice about it, but that was basically the message. And so then it occurs to me, well, wait a second. If I can ping Ubiquity stuff, can I ping things that are not the Synology? Because I've only ever tried pinging the Synology, because why would I try anything else? And then I tried pinging my Mac Mini, and it worked. Then I tried SSHing into my Mac Mini, and it worked. And suddenly, I'm very confused.
Oh, no.
Oh, no, indeed. So then I go back to trying to ping an SSH into the Synology, and it's not working. So then I think, okay, well, is it just Linux-based stuff? So I tried to ping my Raspberry Pi that runs the Pi-hole.
You know what you and need? That does, you need a new Synology.
Oh, tell me about it. I need to get rid of the damn Synology is what it boils down to, but here we are. I try to ping the Raspberry Pi that has the Pi-hole on it, and that doesn't work. So it is just Linux-based stuff. That doesn't make any sense. Wait. I have a second Raspberry Pi in the bedroom that runs my little beloved LED that tells me when the doors are open in the house. Let me ping that. And that piece of shit, beep, I could ping no problem. What the ever-loving fuck is happening, beep, right now? I am so lost. And I realize that when I take a proper assessment of everything, I realize that the only two devices I cannot successfully connect to are the Synology and the Raspberry Pi that runs the Pi hole. Everything else in the network has always been good to go, and I never realized it. By the way, would you like to know why the internet didn't work when teleport was on before? Well, that was because it was all the DHCP clients on the travel router were getting the Raspberry Pi as their DNS server, and guess what they couldn't access?
It's always DNS.
It's DNS, except it isn't in this case. After going back and forth,
oh my God,
with a couple of Good Samaritans on Mastodon, we come to find out it was two very different problems, and none of them were the Ubiquity thing, and all of them were at least tangentially my fault. For the Raspberry, John, I presume you've already seen this, but would you like to add anything, or Marco for that matter, would you like to add or take any stabs as to what's going on?
No, I've already forgotten what you tooted about, but I did see you toot about it.
Okay, would you like to take a stab now then?
Oh, no. I'm terrible at network stuff. But I will say that you describing your flailing here is an example of someone trying to figure out a programming problem who doesn't know how to use a debugger. Like, you just don't have the tools, right? Like, imagine, I mean, Marco doesn't have to imagine, he's a PHP programmer, but imagine programming without access to a debugger.
Right?
Like, well, you can do it, but, like, you're really doing it with one hand tied behind your back, and it's kind of miserable.
Yep. We don't even have a compiler over in PHP land.
Like, right. So, like, you're trying to debug network problems without, like, fundamental understanding of networking, nor access to the basic tools of debugging network problems, which I'm assuming the people on, and to be clear, I don't have that knowledge either, but, like, that's why I just stay far, far away from network stuff if I can.
Right. And so the people on Mastodon, there were a couple of people on Mastodon who were incredibly kind and incredibly patient, and they suggested doing TCP dump on the command line, which will show to the very small degree I understand any of this, which is way less than John and basically zero, it'll show stuff happening via TCP/IP. And it would show on both devices that they were They were getting tickled by like a ping or whatever. If I recall correctly, they were showing that things were coming in. They just weren't responding. So things were really awry. What ended up happening was for the Raspberry Pi, even though I had a DHCP reservation within the Cloud Gateway Fiber, when I set it up 11 billion years ago, for whatever reason, I had statically assigned an IP for it to use. Now, those two IPs matched. It was 192.168.17.152, I believe. So the one that the Raspberry Pi is statically assigning matches the one that the router is issuing. But the subnet mask on the Raspberry Pi was 255.255.0.0. And I don't really know what I'm talking about, but apparently what that means is it was not trying to talk to the right network in order to reply to these requests. So once I changed it to 255.255.255.0 instead of .0.0, suddenly I could reach the Raspberry Pi and all was well with DNS and everything was good again. But that doesn't explain the Synology. The Synology is not responding and it has the correct subnet mask 255.255.255.0. So I don't know what I'm doing. And again, good Samaritans and Mastodon are helping me out. We come to realize that one of my 80 million containers that I use is Portainer, P-O-R-T-A-I-N-E-R, which is basically a way to manage your containers. And the way it does an update for itself is, I guess, it makes a sidecar container that it creates itself and then is supposed to destroy itself and usually does. And that's what modifies the actual container and then the sidecar goes away. Well, the Synology, I don't know, because maybe Portainer wasn't cleaning up well. I don't know what was going on. But the Synology, when I looked at the container manager on the Synology, which is their equivalent of Docker, and I looked at the networks on there, it turns out that one of these brief and no longer running but still existing containers, sidecar containers, was built a Docker network that was 192.168.0.0. So I guess all of this traffic was getting funneled into this Docker network that doesn't really exist. So once I deleted that network from Docker, suddenly the Synology worked. And so now, after I cannot tell you how many hours of banging my head against the wall and of asking for help from Ubiquity and asking for help from the Good Samaritans on Mastodon, I finally got this travel router working and it works great and I freaking love it. And I'm excited to travel with it and see how it is in a real world scenario. I suspect it'll be great for in the car, for hotel rooms. I'm a little worried about how it'll work when we go to like a beach trip where you're renting an entire house. I reckon that maybe it's not going to have strong enough radios to reach, you know, the far corners of the house, especially because generally speaking, when you rent a beach house, the router will be in one extreme corner of the house and the bedrooms will often be in the opposite extreme corner. But all in all, I'm extremely happy about this. And for all the kvetching that Reddit did about DNS leaks and stuff like that, as far as I can tell, when I have teleport enabled, I'm using my Pi hole for DNS, just as I would expect. So we're getting, you know, ad blocking when we're on the travel router. All is good in the world. But gentlemen, what a damn journey it was, which was 98% my own doing.
As most our computer
book, or take like a continuing education course on that.
I probably should, because I know almost nothing.
You just need to learn like a handful of basics and a handful of like debugging tools that you like your go-to tools to basically say like you would with the programming problem. Like I'm sending data here. I think this is what's happening. Let me look at what is happening when I'm leaving my computer. Let me look what's happening when it arrives here. If I'm on my Synology and the traffic arrives there, how does it get routed? What does it go to? And it would have eventually. I mean, I'm assuming you would have been able to walk through the same things that the Mastodon people walked you through to find your rogue. Container with a network that was sucking up traffic.
Yep. What a journey. But I learned some things, not as much as I probably should have, to John's point, but I learned some things and I am very, very happy with it. And I don't think this is the sort of device that would be useful if you're not a Ubiquity person, but at $80, this is a must have if you're a Ubiquity person and assuming you have this need in your life in the first place. Now, maybe you don't, but for me, I freaking love this thing. The physical form factor is so great. I actually do like the little screen on it. I love the little door for the Ethernet ports. I think it's kind of silly, but I love it.
It's called X-Jack.
That's a throwback that we've made a couple times before in the show. It has a little spot for a lanyard if I wanted to attach a lanyard. I love this thing. It's really great. And as long as you actually know what you're doing, I definitely recommend it. So check it out. Titles.
Wow, that was a journey.
I told you. Let's see.
I have a favorite. Where is it? Okay. Where is it? If it's not on there, I'll suggest it in a second. Six Impossible Things. That's my favorite.
I'm good with that.
I like that. I also like RJ45 for scale.
Actually, that is very good as well. I'm good with either of those.
Six Impossible Things. That's my favorite. That was my second place one was, I think... where was the second place one? Tech Gadget of Obligation. Which Marco, I'm assuming you got that from your upbringing. Casey would not get it.
I got nothing. What do you mean?
What I'm referencing with Tech Gadget of Obligation.
I don't think so.
I guess not.
Tell me more.
Holy Day of Obligation. Maybe it's a Catholic thing.
Oh, yeah, we weren't that serious.
All right, yeah.
Like, we went to church, but it was
Ohio.
More...
Yeah,
it was more
Holy
of a
Days
casual...
Holy Days of Obligation. You can look it up on Wikipedia. But anyway, Six Impossible Things is my favorite.
That's fine. I need to vamp for just a second because I forgot to put the sponsor information in here, so hold on. But we can say goodbye to live people if you want. So
yep.
Goodbye, live people.
All right, bye, live people. Thanks for being live people. Same time next week, I believe, right?
I think that's right.
Yeah. Yep. Same time next week. Oh, wait a minute.
Uh-oh.
Concert? Oh, there's a band concert at the school.
You've got to
God.
Some sort of notification
system.
You can
put them in your calendar ahead of time.
Right?
I did put it in my calendar ahead of time.
Yeah, then you have to look.
Well, see, that's where I fall down.
You just
yeah.
put them in, but blindly. It's a write-only system.
All right, so
a worm drive.
We'll figure out when we're doing the show.
It's probably going to be a different night next week. But we'll see. Thanks, live people. We'll see you next week.